GMO, Mithinde, Ojirapo, Kwesi, Ra, Nehemputa, Akan, Eneye, Ojira, Da. That means greetings to all Afurakani, Afurakani people, meaning African black people. Today is Ojira Day. My name is Ojirapo, Kwesi, Ra, Nehemputa, Akan. And this is our second episode of Ojira. I see that we have somebody in the chat. And you send me a message right quick and let me know. Whoever's in the chat, send me a message right quick just to let me know that you can hear me clearly. And we're going to get started in a couple of minutes. We want to go over the document, actually a couple of documents, and I'm going to post them in the chat right quick. We're going to go over Set and Anat, the dating of the contendings of Heru and Set. This sexuality, homosexuality, was never accepted in Kemet. And we're going to go through the divine prohibition against this sexuality, homosexuality, in ancient Kemet. So I'm posting those in the chat right now. Okay, and for the individuals who are listening, you can post in the chat. You have to log in order to post in the chat, in the chat room. If you want to post some questions ahead of time that you already have, or if you have some, you know, as we're going through the information in the first part of the show, if you have some questions, you can post them in the chat. And we're going to take calls like halfway through. Hold on one sec. So if we just want to make sure, you know, people can hear. So somebody just, when you get a chance, send me a message in the chat so we can be clear. And, okay, so I'll post those two documents. There's also the document, which we may get to briefly, the instruction 35 of Ptah Hetep, the proper translation of instruction 35, the prepubescent sexual taboo piece. So I'll post that one just in case we get a chance to get to it. We will touch on it briefly. It's pretty straightforward, but we do want to touch on that as well. Okay, Mirase, so you hear me, cool. All right, let me just take this last piece in here. Actually, and we did mention the text on Kanum Hetep. In fact, let's deal with that one quickly, and then we'll move forward. There's a text, and it's just a short document that we posted. Neah Kanum and Kanum Hetep. And they are actually identical twins, and the wife and their offspring have tried to promote them as bisexuals or homosexuals. So we're talking about this topic because, of course, it's, you know, just this topic in general, because, number one, the whites and their offspring have always attempted to force their perversity, their insanity, in Afurakani, Afuraikaitni culture, African or black culture. This goes back to ancient times, relatively ancient times, meaning during the times of the Assyrians, Persians, Greeks, Romans, the whites and their offspring attempting to force the culture of bisexuality, homosexuality, into ancient Afurakani, Afuraikaitni African culture. We have always recognized that homosexuality, which we refer to also as dissexuality, dis meaning not, so it's a more proper and descriptive term. To be dissexual means sexuality is not really occurring. Real sexuality only occurs between a male and a female. And for Afurakani, Afuraikaitni people, it only occurs between an Afurakani male and an Afuraikaitni female, meaning an African or black male, African or black female. So bisexuality or homosexuality is a manifestation of a spiritual discordance, spiritual perversity, disalignment from the okrawa, the ka, the kaya, the soul, the divine consciousness, or total detachment from that. It's a manifestation of behavioral illness, mental illness, insanity, what we call a dime or madness in Yakan language, but all the languages of Afuraka, Afrakai, we have a term for madness, mental illness, spiritual discordance, spiritual dissonance, spiritual disconnection, spiritual disalignment. So that's what dissexuality is. The whites and their offspring, of course, as spirits of disorder, and they incarnate spirits of disorder, and we dealt with that last week, talking about the difference between the whites and their offspring, Eurasians, Europeans, white Americans, white Hindus, white Arabs, white pseudo-Native Americans, white Latinos, white Hispanics, white Asians, and so forth, all non-black people, all non-Afurakanu, non-Afuraikaitnu people. They are different from us. It's not only the melanin content, which it is. It's not only the phenotype, which it is. It's not only the morphological characteristics, bone structure, and so forth. All of that is connected. But the key difference is we have a krawa, which is the Akan term, male and female term for soul, divine consciousness, the divinity that dwells within the head region and guides us in harmony with divine order at all times if we align with it. We have a ka, a kayak, a kra, a krawa, an ori inu, a semito. The whites and their offspring do not have that. That is our anchor in divine order. Since they do not have that, then they are not anchored in divine order. They incarnate as spirits of disorder. That's all of them. Newborn babies up until the oldest white cracker you can find. It doesn't matter what they do, how they operate. They are born and they exist and come into being without a crop, without an anchored divine order. So therefore, they manifest behavioral behaviors which clearly show who they are, spirits of disorder. Dissexuality is a feature of their culture because this is where they come from. We talked about how a small percentage of our people went up into northern Eurasia, were drawn into northern Eurasia thousands of years ago, a very small percentage were engaged in that perverse practices, disordered practices such as incest, dissexuality, rape, and so forth. Those are the kind of people we would kill in our community. If some of them escaped that and exiled themselves, some of them did that. Some of them went up into northern Eurasia, were drawn up into northern Eurasia. They got caught up during the last ice age. And when they came back, of course, they were melanin deficient. Melanin deficiency doesn't only come from being isolated and the lack of vitamin D and a change in diet. Of course, that all plays a role. But there's also immune deficiency, vitiligo, develops because of immune deficiency, autoimmune disease. The increase in albinism represents the increase in incest. Higher levels of incest greatly increases the incidence of albinism. So that can happen within one generation, within lifetimes. It doesn't take 10, 15,000 years for a group of people who are isolated to lose their pigment. That can happen within a couple of generations through vitiligo, through incest, which they were heavily involved in, as well as the lack of sunlight, change in diet. There's been new information that's been published recently in the so-called scientific community that's dealing with that change in diet that shows, you know, how they began to lose their pigment on a very rapid basis. So we talked about that to an extent last week. But the whites and their offspring, one of their major weapons culturally against our people, which they are trying to use and wield, is forcing dissexuality as a culture amongst our people because they know that fractures families, destroys mindsets, promotes disorder, promotes behavioral illness, mental illness, destructive behavior, self-destructive, which leads to destructive behavior within the group. So as long as disorder can be promoted within our group, it will create chaos and maintain chaos in our group, and we will be self enslaved, self-inflicted wounds perpetually. So this is why the White Nile Spring attempt to force this perversity is no different than poisoning us with genetically modified foods and keeping us ill physically. They wanted to keep us ill spiritually. So they like to poison our mindset, poison our spirit, make us function as spirits of disorder like them. So this is why they promote this perversity. There are a few texts in ancient Kemet, about seven different instances, thousands and thousands of years of culture, thousands and thousands and thousands of texts all over the walls, the temples, tombs, papyri, coffin texts, and so forth, ostraca and everything else. They found about seven instances that they would like to promote as evidence of this sexuality in ancient Kemet. When we talk about ancient Kemet, we're also talking about ancient Afurakai, Afurakite, and contemporary as well, because no Afurakani, Afurakite society has ever accepted this sexuality. The Abosong, the Orisha, the Vodou, the deities hate this sexuality. They always have, and they always will. The Nananum and Samanko, the ancestresses and ancestors who are honorable, hate this sexuality. They always have, and they always will. The Supreme Being, Amenet, Amen, Nyamewa, Nyame, Mawu and Lisa, Mosu and Chukwu and so forth, they hate, repel, reject this sexuality. They always have, and they always will. There has never been a time that they have accepted it, and there has never been a time that they ever will. It's no different than pedophilia, bestiality, or anything else, because all of those are in the same constellation. Now, so when we're talking about ancient Kemet, they found a few texts that they used to try to promote the false idea that these texts represent this sexuality being accepted in Kemet. None of the texts actually represent that. It's totally 100% false and easily disproven. So we've taken four of these references that they make. We've written four articles on them, exposing the lie. There are not only with the whites and their offspring, of course, but of course you have agents of the whites and their offspring in our communities, so-called Hebrew groups, Muslim groups, Christians, of course, these various different pseudo-religious groups, Moors and so forth, and they would try to promote the idea that's becoming kind of popular since they are agents of the whites and their offspring, that ancient Kemet or ancient Egypt was a culture that worshipped homosexuality or worshipped homosexual gods and foolishness like that. Now, the people who started these groups and run these groups, they all know it's inaccurate. All of the whites and their offspring know that it's inaccurate. The reason that they're teaching it is because it's inaccurate. There's not one white so-called scholar who actually believes that ancient Kemet accepted this sexuality, homosexuality. They know it did, but they are liars. This is why they promote that. This is what spirits of disorder do. So we shouldn't be confused. We shouldn't be falling into back and forth arguments. Well, we shouldn't be arguing with those who are inferior to us, which are the whites and offspring, period. But we shouldn't even be engaging in foolish debates with individuals who know that what they're saying is inaccurate, but they're just trying to force the false ideas on the people anyway. These are criminals in the community. Now, you have people who founded these groups, Muslim groups, Hebrew groups, Christian groups, of course, Islamic groups. The whites and their offspring founded these groups decades ago in the black community and put their agents as heads of these groups. They fund these groups. So, of course, the insanity, pseudo-cosmology, pseudo-religion is coming forth from these groups. It doesn't matter how much they scream against the white man and the devil and all of that. They worship the whites and their offspring, Hebrews, Muslims, Christians, all of them. They worship the whites and their offspring. They embrace white culture, and their goal is to corrupt the minds of Afurakani, Afurakaiti people at the behest of their white master. This has always been the case. Then you have people who join up with these groups who don't know any better and assume that they must know something. They're talking about things that sound a little bit different than they heard in church. and like, oh, maybe this is true because they've been conditioned all their lives just growing up in this culture. So basic followers, they don't understand the truth about the information. They just have misinformation. But the people who are the teachers, the instructors, as well as the founders, they know the information they're teaching is 100% inaccurate. This is why they are teaching it. These are enemies in our community. So let's deal with one of the texts very quick. We call it a note on Neon Kanum and Kanum Hetep. So they show Neon Kanum and Kanum Hetep as embracing one another, and they say, well, they're embracing one another. They must be homosexual. They're embracing one another very closely. They're holding on to one another. They're two men. Of course, they're identical twins, but many of the writers don't mention that part. So they say, well, since they're embracing, this is evidence that they must have been homosexuals. Of course, they have wives and families that are shown in their tombs and so forth. So let's deal with them. Neon Kanum, Kanum Hetep are twins. They are named after the divinity, often spelled Kunum, pronounced it Kunem, because Kunem is the potter divinity. He's a ram-headed divinity. He gets on the potter's wheel, and he molds the body of the person and their ka and their soul, their ka or kaet, on behalf of Nyamewa, Nyamea, Amen, Amenet, the Supreme Being. They direct what individual is going to incarnate into the world, and they direct Kunwem, the divine potter, to fashion the body and fashion their ka, or kaya, fashion their soul on the divine potter's wheel and conjoin them. The name Kunwem means to conjoin, to unite, to yoke and unite, to conjoin. That's why he's the potter. We pronounce it Kunwem because, instead of Kunum, because in the Akan language, Oku Kunwem means a potter. So we still have the same name of the deity, Kunwem, which means the divine potter, the conjoiner, and in Akan language, Oku Kunwem is the potter. So Neon Kanum is one twin, Kanum Hetep is the other twin. So let's look at the word for twins. Hatar in ancient Kemet, Hatre in Kapi, the surviving language. Hatar means to join together, to yoke, to unite, and so forth. When the twins are shown in the Medutu for the term Hatar, they are shown together and they're holding hands and they're very close to one another. And it represents twins, Hatar, those who are joined or united or yoked. Now, we can pronounce it Hatar because in Akan the word for twins is Hatar. Same term from Kemet, same term in the Akan language. So when you look at the Medut, the determinative Medut, you see the two twins together holding hands very closely, exactly like the images Neon Kanum and Kanum Hetep. So then in this article, quickly we go and we show what the name Kanum means. He is a potter. We show an image of him sitting at his divine potter's wheel, fashioning the body of the person and the ka, or the kayet, the person, and he conjoins them as Kunwem. He joins the soul and the body together. He's the one that joins them together in the womb. He does that for all of us. But he's also, because of that, a patron deity of twins, because he's the conjoiner, and the word for twins means to conjoin, those who are conjoined in the womb together, and those, who, as they say with Neon Kanum and Kanum Hetep, they were conjoined and after death. They came into the world together and they died together, so to speak. So this is where that comes from. Even with the name, Neon Kanum and Kanum Hetep, Neonk is, of course, life, the life energy. Kanum is the conjoiner. Then you have Kanum Hetep. Hetep means peace, to be at rest, and so forth. When you look at the determinative Medut, of course, it's a loaf on a platter, but it's also a representative of the sun setting in the west, the sun resting in peace, coming to an end, and so forth. That's why Kanum Hetep is the second born. He's the one who came after. Neon Kanum is the firstborn. This has to do with the cosmology of the culture. in Akan culture, amongst the Bono Akan, for example, as well as amongst the Yoruba people. When we talk about twins, twins are governed by divinity, sacred forces in nature. They are different breeds, so to speak. They're governed by forces in nature. When those two spirits are conjoined in the womb, it represents a different kind of expansive and contractive energy, and there are certain abosom or orisha or vodu that govern twins. And ancient Kemet, one of those patron divinities of twins, is Kunwim or Kunun. Now, in Bono Akan tradition as well as in Yoruba tradition, the first twin that comes out, born, is not the oldest twin. The second twin that comes out, that's the elder or elderly. And the reason for that in both cultures is because the way our cultures are structured, when an elder is coming to a new territory, a new region, first the elder or the elderest sends a courier out or a messenger out or a hunter out to survey the land, to check out the land, check out the territory, clear the way, clear the path. And once they do that, then they clear the way for the elder or the elderest to come into the region as well. You don't just send the elder or elderest out first. You send the one who can scout the land out first, on a mission first. So the first twin that comes out of the womb, he's not the elder or she's not the elder. They're the scout. They're the one that comes out. They're the younger. They come out first. They survey the area, and then they open the way for the elder or elders to come out of the womb. So Ni'ankh Kanum was the firstborn. Ankh, life. Ni is the vibratory frequency. And when you see that that Medut is a person walking with vibratory, the waves of energy for the letter N, but also electromagnetic waves in their hand. Ankh, life force energy. So Ni'ankh Kanum is the first life that bursts forth from the womb. And then Kanum Hetep, the one who comes after the elder at rest and so forth, comes to an end, brings that to a close, that whole birthing process, that's the second born. So this is why they have these names as part of our cosmology. They're identical twins, they're governed by this divinity and so forth. So that all of that cosmology is wrapped up into the personhood of Ni'ankh Kanum and Kanum Hetep. It's cosmological and it's also ritual and so forth. So that's just a quick piece. And, of course, this document, we posted the, I think we posted the link in the chat. No, we didn't. So let me post that right now. And if anybody has any questions on that, you can put that up. Linking that up right now. All of these, by the way, all of the documents, all four of the documents we'll be addressing tonight are on the website. They're all free downloads, odwirafo.com, O-D-W-I-R-A-F, as in free, O.com. And on the front, on the index page, when you scroll down, you'll find these documents as well as the others. We have about 12 books, about 60 research articles. We have about 48 videos, most of them about 2 hours each. All of those are free downloads, the PDF versions of the books, the e-books, and so forth. And the documents. We also have soft cover versions of 7 of our books, and we do sell the soft cover versions. We print them ourselves, and we sell them, print them in color and sell them, but the PDF versions, the e-books, are all free. And, of course, these documents are all free downloads as well. Okay, so let's deal with Set and Anat. First, we're going to talk about quickly Set and Anat and its relevance, and then we're going to talk about the other document first, and we'll get back to Set and Anat. Now, the major texts that the White Narrow Spring used to try to prove that this sexuality, homosexuality, existed as a culture in ancient Kemet is the Contendings of Heru and Seth, because there's an episode within a version of that text, a curious episode where it states that Seth, the divinity, the deity Seth, attempted unsuccessfully to sodomize Heru, the deity Heru. Now, because this particular rendering has this episode, out of all the thousands of texts in ancient Kemet over thousands of years, one particular rendering and its variation found in the Chester Beatty Papyrus and then the Kahun Medical Papyrus is a series of papyri that those two texts, it's the same story, just a little variation. That those particular texts, the same text, the same rendering, is the only place you find that dealing with Heru and Set in all of the truestry of ancient Kemet. So they find this text, and then they promote the idea that because this episode, which is unusual, shows up for some reason at this particular time in this particular text, then it must prove that homosexuality or dissexuality was accepted in Kemet, because if the deities were doing it, it must be okay. Now, we will show, and we have shown in this document, that number one, dissexuality was never accepted in ancient Kemet. We will also show through the document that you can properly date the document, not just chronologically, but culturally, what was going on culturally. Whenever the whites and their offspring show up, and this is a rule across the board, whenever the whites and their offspring show up in an Afro-Akani, Afro-Akani culture, that's when dissexuality or homosexuality shows up, or references to that shows up, because that is their culture. That's their perverse, deviant culture. That's who they are, and they try to force that perversity and introduce that perversity everywhere they go. They've been doing that since ancient times. Their fake deities like Zeus raping little boys and their gods engaged in that kind of nonsense, that perversity, has been part of their culture and their pseudo-cosmology, what they dedicated their lives to. Their boys, when they would take them through rites of passage, were forced to have, and of course they accepted, a male so-called lover or deviant, pedophile. That was part of their culture, a rites of passage for white boys in their culture. That's who they are. So they try to force that perversity on the cultures that they invade, our culture. But of course we don't accept that. So this is what they do. They've done in ancient times. They're doing it today, of course. They're heavily promoting so-called same-sex marriage. This is what the whites and their offspring have always done ever since they've existed, whenever they could. They're trying to force it not only, of course, in America, but they're also trying to force the acceptance of same-sex marriage, deviance, pedophilia, all of that on the continent of Afro-Akai, Afro-Akai, and they're trying to tie financial aid from the United States and from Europe to the acceptance of dissexuality, homosexuality on the continent. And if those countries who say we're not going to accept that, we're not going to allow that, we're not going to get rid of our sodomy laws and so forth, then they'll say, well, we're not going to give you any aid. We're going to force you, if you're foolish enough to embrace our initiatives, we're going to force you to reject your laws on the criminalization of homosexuality. We're going to make you get rid of those laws, make you accept same-sex marriage in your country, and then we'll give you some money. Some people have stood up against that. In Uganda, they stood up against that. In Zimbabwe, they stood up against it. Of course, in Nigeria, they stood up against it. Some people are standing up against it, some are going to continue. The ones who are intelligent will. And when we give this kind of information out, it helps strengthen the people on the continent. We just got a call or an email from a brother today in South Africa, Afro-Akai. They're, of course, trying to force that perversity in that country as well. One of the tactics is to teach people that the only reason sodomy laws became popular in Afro-Akai, Afro-Akai, whites and offspring lie and say that that was a result of colonialism and the introduction of Christianity and Judeo-Christian values. And what we're really doing is embracing, colonial values as African people, and that's the only reason we have sodomy laws. But in our traditional culture, we were tolerant of homosexuality, and what we need to leave colonialism alone and leave those colonial beliefs alone and get back to our traditional culture, which was accepting of Christianity. That's the lie that they're pushing. And many people on the continent have believed that because white people have published one or two articles with misinformation. One of them is called Boy Wives and all this other nonsense, which is totally inaccurate. One of them attempting to implicate King Kabaka in Uganda, which one of his descendants wrote a piece recently just totally destroying that whole lie. They never accepted the sexuality. So what has happened, the brother in South Africa, emailed me and said the documents that we published in this regard proving that these people are liars, proving that the divine prohibition against this sexuality existed in our cultures from thousands of years ago and still exists today, that shattered that misinformation, those myths, those lies that they are attempting to promote right now. So people are starting to get that information and realize, wait a minute, we've never accepted homosexuality. Here's proof in the texts of ancient Kemet, of our ancestors and ancestors, thousands of years before there was a such thing as Christianity, Islam, Hebrewism, and so forth. So what we've put out now is actually strengthening our people on the continent and everywhere else. So this is how we can affect and bring positive change to our people in the world, around the world, when we do the work here. So with the text of Set and Anat that we're talking about, that curious episode, they try to say, okay, well, they were accepting homosexuality. What we show with the dates is that when the whites and their offspring show up in ancient Kemet, then references to this sexuality show up. These two references to this sexuality show up when the whites and their offspring show up. In the text of the contendings of Heru and Set, the key piece that's critical is when they're at the tribunal. Heru and Set are fighting for who's going to be the next king after Ossar has been murdered. Ossar is in the ancestral realm. Heru has been born and grows up. He's fighting against Set, and they're going to determine who's going to be the rightful heir to Ossar, to the throne. And they've been fighting and going back and forth. They go before the tribunal of the divinities, of the Ntoru, Ntorutu, the deities, so-called Neteru, Neteretu, and there's a disagreement. So Ra, the creator, directs Tehuti, the divine wisdom and the scribe of all the divinities, to write a letter to the great mother divinity, Neith, to ask her what is her verdict, what is her assessment. This is an ancient practice, and it's still practiced by the Akan today. The Akan rule by consensus. So when the tribunal of Nananun Mpanyinfo, with the elders, honorable elders and elderesses, when we're trying to decide what's going to happen, in those few instances where we can't arrive at a consensus, a small select group of Mpanyinfo, Nananun Mpanyinfo elders and elderesses will say, Yekobisa Abrewa, we are going to consult the old woman, the elder woman, the elderest woman. And they lead the venue. They consult with the elder woman that represents the queen mother, but also the earth mother. And then when they come back with a verdict from the elder woman, then that's the end of the debate, and that's going to be the rule. That's a carryover from what we did in ancient Kemet, when the deities couldn't come to a consensus of who should rule, who should be the next heir. Should it be the brother of Ossar or the son of Ossar? And the creator of the universe tells Tehuti, write a letter to the great mother and ask what her opinion is. Her response is key. She says, number one, Heru is the rightful heir. Do not disparage him. Do not take his rightful role away from him. Give him the throne of Ossar. However, give Set something as well. Double his inheritance. Give him your two daughters, Anat and Astarte. That is critical because Anat and Astarte are foreign goddesses, foreign divinities. So that dates the text. They are already incorporated in the cosmology, in this rendering of the text, as daughters of Ra. That means these two foreign deities, so-called Semitic deities or Kanani deities, Canaanite deities, foreign divinities have already been incorporated in the cosmology. This means that so-called Semitic speakers, so-called Heku, Shasu, and others, so-called Hyksos and others, had already infiltrated Kemet and entrenched themselves to the extent that deities that they dealt with were already incorporated and entrenched as part of the cosmology to the extent that they were daughters of Ra. This dates the text politically, not just chronologically, but politically. It shows when the whites invaded, when they infiltrated, and they had enough influence where the text is including non-Kamal divinities in its cosmology. It was very rare that the people of ancient Kemet would incorporate foreign divinities. There are only a few instances within the thousands of years of so-called dynastic truestry, and this is one of those instances. So it shows that once the foreign divinities, meaning the foreign people who brought this information about these divinities, show up, then all of a sudden there are references at the same time of this sexuality showing up. A small reference that doesn't exist anywhere else in the various stories all over Kemet. So that's key. So we're going to go into that, but first let's deal with the actual divine prohibition against this sexuality as found in the text of Kemet. So that document we posted is called the Divine Prohibition Against Dissexuality, Homosexuality in Ancient Kemet. What we show is what are commonly called the 42 Declarations of Innocence, the 42 Laws of Ma'at, or Admonitions of Ma'at. Some people refer to them as the 42 Negative Confessions and so forth. Chapter 125, Plate 31 in the Ani Shestu, or the Ani Papyrus of Ani of the Runu Pertem Heru, the so-called Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Book of Coming Forth by Dead. Chapter 125, Plate 31, there are 42 Declarations of Innocence, and number 11 deals with dissexuality and the prohibition against dissexuality. Let's just read from the text what it actually said. It says, Ah kereti perhem amintet anak na, which means Hail kereti, which is a divinity, the one who comes forth from the land of the west, amintet. I have not penetrated nok with a penetrator, or I have not copulated nok with a copulator nok. The determinative medut, or penetrator or copulator in this text, and we show the actual medut in the article, is an erect phallus with seminal fluid coming out. So the term for copulation or penetration, talking about the sex act, is nok. It's spelled N-K, but then in Coptic, nok or noek, and it means to penetrate, to copulate, to quote-unquote have sex. But it shows the actual medut of an erect phallus with seminal fluid coming out. It says, not have I penetrated with a penetrator. I have not copulated with somebody who copulates. I have not penetrated someone who can penetrate. I have not engaged in sexual activity with somebody who has the same sexual apparatus. It's clear proof of that in the text, direct proof. Now, why do they have 42 negative confessions or declarations of innocence? This is not just 42 commandments. That's not what's happening. There are 42 abosom, 42 divinities that we must invoke when somebody makes their transition and they're going from the physical world, we go to the ancestral realm. We become accepted into the ancestral realm to live in harmony with the honorable ancestresses and ancestors in a peaceful environment, if we were living in harmony with order. If we were not, we would be repelled naturally because we become repulsive too because of our disordered energy. It's like two magnets on the table that repel one another when the same polarities are facing one another. When you engage in disordered activity and your spirit is disordered and disaligned, you make yourself repulsive to those who live in harmony with order. That means you make yourself repulsive to the Nananun and Samanto, the ancestresses and ancestors who are honorable. You make yourself repulsive to the Abosom, to the Orisha, to the Vodou, to the divinities, the forces in nature, the children of the great mother and great father, because they are embodiments of divine order, and the only energy that they radiate is ordered energy. If you come with disordered, discordant, perverse energy, you become repulsive to them and repelled by them. The same with the Nananom Msamako, the ancestors of the ancestors. It's the same with us individually. When we come in contact with somebody who's deviant and perverse, we can feel a negative energy. If somebody's a pedophile or something like that, or a criminal, murderer, we're engaged in some kind of perverse activity, we don't even have to know the person. We can feel the negative, repulsive energy, and we want to get as far away from that individual as possible. And that kind of individual makes their transition. If they were disaligned, then they are repulsive to the Nananom Msamako, the Aku to the ancestors of an ancestor. They will not be able to enter into that region of the ancestral realm where the honorable ancestors of the ancestors are. They can only be around those who are on the same frequency, the perverse, discordant spirits. Many of them who are earthbound, walking around, hanging around houses where they were murdered or where they died, hanging around places where they were killed, places where they died in the street and so forth, and causing problems by harassing people who move throughout those areas. So when we make our transition, and if we're harmonious, we go before these 42 different Abosom, and we invoke them. No different than when people invoke the Abosom or Risha Vodou today. Spirit possession, communication, they get inside the bodies of our people. They speak, they communicate, they teach, they heal. We invoke them ritually. We align our spirits with theirs. Once we align our spirits with theirs, our energy is replenished. The Abosom have shrines in our bodies. Our organs and organ systems are the physical shrines of the various Abosom within our body. When we align with them ritually, we invoke them, then we align our energy with theirs, our energy is fused with theirs, we align with them, and then they replenish our energy. The shrines in our bodies that carry their energy is replenished. And therefore, we fuse with them, and we harmonize, and we're in order. And we go to the next, every divinity we have to invoke. So very often people read the 42 declarations of Ma'at, and they just read them as, you know, 42 commandments, like the Ten Commandments. And, of course, the Ten Commandments were taken from that. But that's not what people were doing in ancient Kemet. They invoked the divinity. They ritually invoked them, no different than somebody pouring libation, forcing nature to come forward, and a Rishi comes forward and possesses the person. We're literally going before these Abosom and invoking them. And when we invoke each one has its own name. They have their own characteristic, and we show that we were in alignment with this force in nature when we come before them. If we are in alignment with them, then they replenish our energy, and it opens the way for us to move forward. Each one of the 42 divinities, we must invoke, ritually align our spirit with theirs, be replenished, infused with their energy, and replenished by their energy. And once we go through all 42, just like all the various organs and organ systems in the body, that's a holistic process. Our entire physical bodies, if we were doing that on Earth, when we go before the shrines of the Abosom today and pour libation and engage in ritual song, ritual dance, and invoke their energy, and they come and possess us and infuse us and cleanse us and so forth, spiritually, when our spirit, when we're spirits after death, move in the company of these Abosom, we invoke them ritually just like we did on Earth. They embrace us. They fuse their energy with ours. They realign us. They replenish our energy. And then that opens the way for us to move to the ancestral realm in harmony. So this is what we're doing. There are 42 divinities, just like there are 42 days in the ritual calendar of the Akan people. Every day is governed by a divinity in Akan culture, one or more divinities. So this is what the 42 declarations of innocence are. Each divinity has its own name, its own function in creation, its own shrine in our body, so each one has a specific thing that they do, that they govern in creation. This is why we say in the text, in the process of accepting or receiving the infusion of energy, before I go, let's go up a little bit so so you can get a snapshot. And this is on page one of that document, Divine Prohibition Against Dissexuality, Homosexuality, and Ancient Kemet. In order to live in harmony and perpetuity after death in the ancestral realm, as well as during life in the physical realm, the Apurakani, Apuraikaitni individual must ritually invoke the 42 Ntoru, Ntorutu gods, goddesses, who are judges of Ma'a and Ma'at, divine law, in order to harmonize with the energy of the Ntoru, Ntorutu, the spirit forces of creation, the embodiments of divine order in creation. Their energy is invoked. Once the energy is invoked or called, it can be internalized, infused, and replenished within the individual. So the reason we provoke through libation or provoke through ritual prayer, provoke through ritual dance or ritual song here in the world is to stimulate, provoke their energy, and once it's called, then that energy can be internalized, infused, and replenished within us. It's the same thing after death. We invoke them. And once we do that, we provoke their energy, we provoke a response, and that energy is internalized, infused, and replenished within the individual. Like a drop of water fusing with a river, harmonizing with this greater force or body of water in nature, so does the Apurakani, Apuraikai, the individual, fuse his or her energy with the energy of the spirit force in nature that he or she is invoking ritually. This opens the way for one to align himself or herself with the divine order of creation. So we invoke them to receive their energy. When we receive their energy, it replenishes us. It's no different than going out in the sun and receiving that energy. It gets inside of us. It rejuvenates us. It stimulates us. It helps us to develop, you know, the creation of vitamin D and everything else. We photosynthesize that energy with our abatun, with our melanin, and so forth. So we receive the energy, internalize it, and replenish our own energy with that solar energy. However, in the process of accepting or receiving the infusion of energy, divinely ordered energy of the Ntoru, Ntorutu, the individual must reject perversity, disordered energy, which can manifest as a result of disordered thoughts, intentions, and or actions. The individual thus invokes or accepts the energy of the deity, the spirits of divine order, and rejects or repels disorder. Now, you're doing both. This is divine law or love and divine hate, the two poles of divine order. You accept what is orderly, and you reject what is disorderly. You invoke so that you can accept, and then you also reject disorder so that you can harmonize with the Avoto. All right. So, then we next say, in the passage below, the individual invokes the Ntoro, or the deity, Tererti, the Ntoro of the caverns, the holes, the Keret, gateways to the spirit realm. He who comes forth from Amentet, the land of the west, the ancestral realm. The individual invokes, calls forth, accepts, receives the energy of this Ntoro, and he also rejects, repels thoughts, intentions, and actions that are repulsive to this Ntoro or deity, and thus the divine order of creation. He states, therefore, that he is not copulated or penetrated, meaning entered the hole or cavern, Keret, of a copulator or penetrator. The only hole or cavern, Keret, that a male should enter during copulation is that of the female whose cavern, the Kaet, vagina, is also associated in ancient Kemet with the opening or the hole to the Duat or the ancestral realm whose gate is Amentet. So there's a specific reason why the divinity Kereti, the divinity who comes forth from the west, the land of the setting sun, the gateway or the hole or the cavern that goes into the ancestral realm, that particular divinity that governs that hole or that cavern, he invokes that divinity, the 11th one, saying that I have not copulated or entered the hole of a copulator. He's telling the divinity that governs the divine gateway or the divine hole or the divine cavern, I've only entered the right hole. That's the only hole that I've entered, and I haven't entered the wrong one. So when he invokes that divinity and replenishes his energy, he also rejects the perversity that would otherwise get him outside of harmony with that divinity. Number 11. So we have the actual text. We have the, you know, Medut and everything, and we go into detail about that in the article. We also show a little bit more information. One of the terms for the ancestral realm is the Duat in ancient Kemet. Of course, in American English parlance, the word Duat becomes Twat, and that's a, you know, a colloquialism for a vagina, Tuat, or the gateway to the ancestral realm. If you look at the Aposom Nut, the goddess Nut, she's bent over the sky, she swallows the sun, and she gives birth to the sun in the morning. It comes out of her Duat, it comes out of her vagina, so to speak. She gives birth to the sun. So her Duat is an opening, her vagina is an opening to the Duat. It's a keter, it's a cavern, it's a hole, it's an opening to the ancestral realm. One of her two openings to the ancestral realm. So Tuat becomes Twat in English, but it's also called Etwa in Akan. The vagina is Etwa in Akan. Etwa and Twat or Duat is the same term from ancient Kemet to the Akan language. So we talk about that. We talk about the Ka, Kaet, vagina, the opening, the hole. It's also the Keret, the hole. So we show the connection between the deity Keret Ti, the deity that governs the caverns, that when the sun sets in the west, and it says Keret Ti, the divinity who comes forth from Amentet, the land of the setting sun, the land of the west, the land of the ancestresses and ancestors, where the sun set in the west, in the Amentet, and that's the gateway to the ancestral realm, the hole, the cavern that the sun goes into, and of course the Shatim Duat is the book of caverns and so forth. We show the connection between all of that. Cherti is the divinity that governs that gateway to the ancestral realm, the divine whole, so to speak. So when you invoke that divinity, you're saying the only whole that I've entered is that of a female. I have not entered the whole of, I have not copulated with a copulate. So that's a divine prohibition against that. If you do not invoke Cherti and prove to that divinity that governs the divine whole, divine cavern, the gateway to the ancestral realm, if you do not prove to him that you have not copulated with a copulator, then you will not be accepted by the Arbosong. You will not be accepted to the ancestral realm. You will be consumed. Your heart will be consumed and destroyed by Amuk. You'll be ritually, spiritually consumed and destroyed, and now you'll be an earthbound, corrupt spirit that's not accepted because you engaged in disorder. So that's a divine prohibition against this sexuality. That is irrefutable, and nobody can challenge that. That's a reality. The Abosom despise this sexuality today. They always have. The forces of nature always have. They have spoken on that, not only through these texts in ancient Kemet, but through the people in ancient Kemet. They speak today. Whenever they possess today, in America, in the bodies of our people today, when they communicate with us through divination today, when they communicate with us at the shrines today, they consistently tell us that they hate this sexuality, homosexuality. They always have and always will. They did in the past and they will continue in the future. So that's the direct evidence of that. Let me check the chat real quick and then we're going to get into the text for Set and I'm not. All right. Okay, let me pull it up right quick. All right, so for people who are on the computer, you can go through the text, Set and I'm not, the dating of contending of Heru and Set. So there are two quick things here. Number one, we said initially in the introduction that whenever the wife and their offspring show up, then references to this sexuality show up. And this is exactly what happened, and we showed that Anat and Astarte, two foreign divinities, are already incorporated in this rendering of the text as daughters of Ra, therefore proving that infiltration had already happened to the extent that they were so entrenched in the culture that they became part of the cosmology, and even the deities are calling them daughters of Ra. So now you can see where this sexuality comes in, this peculiar episode. And we're going to go through the episode, and then we're going to show even further that the original story did not have Set sodomizing Heru. The original story had Set raping the seed goddess. And for some reason later on, the seed goddess was removed from the story, and Heru was put in the story by the whites and their offspring. So we'll talk about that as well. So And that proves further that the sexuality was not accepted. The whites and their offspring exchanging roles of deity and making an episode of Set and the Sea Goddess becoming an episode with Set and Heru. That's a political move, and we're going to get into that, which nobody has brought out until we publish this document. But first, we're going to go through the text as it is written, as it is rendered, and even as it is rendered, it's still a repudiation of this sexuality. Even though the episode is peculiar, it's not part of our original culture, but even as it is written, as crudely and disordered as it is written, it still repudiates this sexuality. So, for example, the text talks about Set attempting to sodomize Heru. So, part of the text, Chesterbaity Papyrus number 1. Set attempts to sodomize Heru when Heru is asleep. However, Heru blocks Set from doing so with his hand. Heru then immediately goes to his mother, Offset, to report on what Set had attempted to do. So then what we do is we quote from the text, and it says, quote, Heru went to tell his mother, Offset, help me, Offset, my mother, come and see what Set has done to me. And he opened his hand and let her see Set's seed or semen. Now, what Offset did next, and we put it in bold, she let out a loud scream, seized the copper knife, cut off his hand that were equivalent, and threw it in the river. So, in the text, Set tries to sodomize Heru when he's asleep. Heru put his hand back there and blocked Set from being able to do so. And we'll prove later in the text that Set never was able to actually successfully do that. When somebody's lustful, even just the touch of somebody else will make them release their seminal fluid. So this is what is showing how lustful in this particular instance, in this rendering of the text, even though it's not the original text, but we're just going to show what's in this rendering, is showing that Set was so lustful that he tried to sodomize Heru. So Heru put his hand back there to block him from being able to do that, and some of the fluid got on Heru's hand. So Heru immediately jumps up, runs to his mother, and says, look at what Set has tried to do to me. And he opened up his hand, and Set's fluid was on his hand. Offset screams, lets out a loud scream, immediately grabs a copper knife and cuts his hand off. Now, Offset is a divinity. She's known as the great killeress. Can heal the deities, resurrect the dead, resurrect Al-Sar, kill any kind of illness. But because the seminal fluid of a male touching that of another male was so perverse, in fact, the word for seminal fluid or seed is moot, but then that word is also the word for poison, and then moot is also the word for death. So when the seed is inside the female, it's seminal fluid, and you can impregnate the female. When the seed is not inside of the female, then moot seed becomes moot poison. So the seminal fluid touching the hand of another male, that was so objectionable that even the great goddess who can heal and resurrect the dead couldn't clean Heru's hand off. She had to cut it off and throw it away and make him a new hand. That's a repudiation of even the idea of this sexuality. If the idea, the fact that you even, your hand touched the fluid of another male was enough for you to grab a knife and cut the hand off. If you can imagine here in America, somebody, a son telling his mother, hey, my uncle tried to sodomize me and some of that fluid got on my hand, and the first thing she did was grab a machete or a butcher knife out of the kitchen drawer and chop his hand off. That's how extreme and perverse the idea of this sexuality is and was to our people, to the extent that the great killeress of the universe could not heal his hand, so she had to make him a brand new. That's a repudiation off the bat. Now, we go further, we talk about that, and then if you go to page 2, we're going to get into that. We talk about the repudiation of the idea. We also talk about, in the text, it shows that the seed, semen of Set, never enters Heru's body. Moreover, it shows that Ntotu, the deity's absolute disgust at the very possibility of sodomy, that sodomy may have occurred. yet they would later find out that sodomy did not occur. So even in this perverse rendering of the text, the sodomy never actually occurred. So we quote from the text. Said Seth, he's standing before the tribunal of the deity. Let me be awarded the office of ruler, for as to Heru, the one who is standing trial, I have performed the labor of a male against him, trying to say that he performed sodomy against him and performed the labor of a male against him. He made that charge against Heru before the tribunal of the divinity. The Ennead, or the tribunal of the divinities, let out a loud cry. They spewed and spat at Heru's face. So again, the idea that Set lied, he said he performed the labor of a male against Heru, it wasn't true. But when the deities first heard that, they were so disgusted that they let out a loud cry and they began to spit and spew at Heru's face because they assumed that it might have been accurate. Now Heru laughed at them. This is the text going on. He then took an oath by the god as follows. All that Set has said is false. Let Set's seed or semen be summoned that we may see from where it answers, and my own be summoned that we may see from where it answers. Then Tahuti, lord of the script and scribe of truth for the divinities, put his hand on Heru's shoulder and said, come out, you semen of Set. And it answered him from the water in the interior of the marsh. So Tahuti, the divine wisdom, also a divine healer, went up to Heru, put his hand on his shoulder. He said, seed of Set, come out of his body. If the seed of Set was in his body, it would have come out. But the seed of Set answered him from the marsh. Why did it answer him from the marsh? Because when Set cut off Heru's hand that had seed of Set on it, she threw his hand into the marshes, into the water. So when Tahuti walked up to see, well, if Set said that he performed sodomy against Heru, then his seed must be in Heru's body, and I'll be able to call it forth. He called the seed forth, but it didn't answer from inside Heru's body. It answered from the marshes because that's where it was thrown. So that proved what Heru said, that all that Set said is false. He was never sodomized. Now, the reason, and we explain that part. And then we show actually the cost lettuce that Set was, you know, used to eating. What happened was there was Set tried to trick Set. She put seminal fluid of Heru. She gave Heru some ointment. It caused him to release some seminal fluid. She captured that fluid in a pot, and she took that fluid. And, of course, remember the fluid moot. Once it comes out of the body, becomes moot, poison. She took that fluid and she poured it on the cost lettuce that Set usually ate every morning. Knowing that Set was very lustful, he would go in the morning, assume that that lettuce didn't have the feces-type matter or the poisonous matter, the seminal fluid of Heru on it. He would assume that it was a natural sap coming from the cost lettuce, because when you look at that cost lettuce and we have a picture of it, it releases a white fluid substance. So Set walked in the garden the next morning. He grabbed the lettuce that he normally eats, and he just ate it. He's so lustful and not in harmony with order that he didn't realize that there was poison or seminal fluid. He just assumed it was that. If you're not in harmony with order, if somebody placed some feces on some lettuce in the grocery store, if you're just a little bit in tune with order, you would smell that there's something wrong, and you wouldn't, of course, buy the lettuce. If you're just lustful and just ready to put anything in your mouth, because you're engaged in disorder, you won't even pay attention. You just grab it and put it in your mouth and find out later and get sick later. Set, being so lustful, he just went and grabbed the lettuce and ate it. So now the seed or the semen of Heru, poison, is now in the body of Set. So when Tahuti goes to Set and puts his hand on Set's shoulder and says, seed of Heru, come out, the seed of Heru answers. And we have the text, and we'll quote from that. It says, Tahuti put his hand on Set's shoulder and said, come out, you seed of Heru. Then it said to him, where shall I come from? Tahuti said to it, come out of his ear. Thereupon the seed of Heru said to him, is it from his ear that I should issue forth, seeing that I am divine seed? and Tahuti said to it, come out from the top of his head. And then it emerged as a golden solar disk upon said Seth's head. Seth became exceedingly furious and extended his hands to seize this golden solar disk. Tahuti took it away from him. So when he put his hand on Heru's shoulder, the seed of Seth wasn't in him. It responded from the marsh because it never got inside of his body. He put his hand on Seth's shoulder and said, hey, seed of Heru, come out. And it turns out it was in his body because he was foolish enough to eat that poison that was on the lettuce. And it crawled from inside of his body. Tahuti said, come out of his ear. And the seed said, I'm divine seed, should not come out of the top of his head. So it came out of the top of his head in the form of a solar disk. This is critical. And we're going to talk about why coming out of the top of the head is critical to show how they perverted the text. The whites and their offspring perverted the text. So at the end of that, the company of the divinity said, Heru is right and Set is wrong. They acknowledged the fact that Set had lied about sodomizing Heru. And therefore, so in the text we say, the context in this rendering was that Set was attempting to rob Heru of his inheritance, the throne of Al-Sar, divine kingship. He wants to rule himself, of course, after having Al-Sar killed. He planned all these different deceptions and tricks and contests against Heru. He tried all kinds to try to take the kingship, you know, away from Heru in the eyes of the divinity. All the schemes failed. Set then moved in this rendering to disqualify Heru by making it appear that Heru was a bisexual homosexual, thereby immediately disqualifying him. If he could disqualify Heru by saying that Heru was accepting of bisexuality, he knew that would disqualify Heru from being king, and therefore, by default, the only one being left would be Set to be king. This was his insane thinking. When somebody's controlled by lust and foolishness, they will have insane calculation. And we know people who think like that. But the key is that this sexuality would have disqualified Heru. That's why Heru had to prove to everyone that he was not a bisexual, or else it would disqualify him. This is why the deity spit at him when Set suggested that maybe Heru was a bisexual. This is why Offset cut his hand off when the idea of seminal fluid touching his skin came to her. She said, well, we have to cut off the hand. We couldn't even heal it. These are repudiations of this sexuality to the most extreme level, even in this perverse rendering. Now, and we mentioned that, and that's on page 3. Now, let's get to key 3. Set, Anat, and foreigners. We already talked about Anat and Astarte being foreign divinity, foreigners, incorporated into the culture. There is a rendering. There's a particular text, and we're just going to jump through this quickly and get to the text. And it's talking about Set and Anat. In Kanana, or Canaan, and in the Levant, the divinity called Baal is identified with Set when the so-called Semitic speakers come into ancient Kemet. So Set's name is, one of his titles is Baar, B-A-R, because there's no L in ancient Kemet, just like there's no L in the Akan language. There's a rolling R. So he's called Baar, or Baar. Set is called Baar, and it's spelled that way, B-A-R in the Medusa. This is the same term, Baal. So Set is called Baal, and even the determinative for Baar is the Set, the unique Set animal. Set is married to Anat in Kemet when Anat and Astarte become infused in the cosmology. In Kanana and in the Levant, Set, with actually Baal, is married to Anat in the Levant. So it's the same marriage, Baal and Anat in the Levant, Set or Baal and Anat in Kemet, once Anat comes into Kemet. Story, magical spells for protection against scorpions. And we're talking about, and this is in, what page were we on? Page 8. And you can look at page 8 in the document. We're going to go through that. Now, and we show, in fact, we show some images of Anat and Kemet in the previous pages. We show images of Baal wearing the white crown, the hedge crown of ancient of southern Kemet. And we also show Baal once the Europeans began to invade, because originally the Levant was populated by Afurakani, Afurakaiji people. But when the whites and their offspring invaded, then things begin to change. The way the deities look begins to change. Their phenotype changes. Their hair changes and everything. So we'll show an image of Baal wearing the white crown of ancient Kemet, southern Kemet. Then we show next to that, once Baal becomes transformed into the image of the white invaders of the Levant, now he has European features, his hair looks European, his body type becomes European, and so forth. So we show images of that. Now, in Kanana, in Canaan, Baal is the husband of Anat. Baal takes the form of a bull. Anat takes the form of a cow. It's the same thing in ancient Kemet. Baal is defined, is identified with Set. Now, here's the key. There's a very important spell for protection against scorpions written during the Ramesu period in Kemet that is important for this discussion. It deals with Set, who, although he's married to Anat, the foreign deity, he comes across a goddess called the seed goddess, a spirit who operates as the energy of the seed or the seminal fluid of Ra. This goddess, when Set sees the seed goddess bathing in the river, he proceeds, as they say in the text, to leap upon her like a ram, and he rapes her. However, because he raped the seed goddess, who is protected by Ra, for she is the energy carrying Ra's seed, seminal fluid, Set became ill. You can't rape the seed goddess who's protected by Ra and then just be all right. He rapes the seed goddess and then he becomes ill because she governs and carries the seed of Ra. He became ill. The seed semen, which is moot, seed or semen, but when it's outside of the proper context, moot also means poison. It's now poison. It goes to Set's head and the brows of his eyes. He lays upon his bed ill. His wife, Anat, takes note of his condition, and then she goes to appeal to Ra to heal him. Ra judges that Set deserves to be ill because he raped the seed goddess. Ultimately, Set comes to heal Set of his illness, and then we have excerpts. This is the Chester Beatty Papyrus number 7. In that particular text, Ra is called Pra, Para, or Pra, or Pre, and so forth. And then we quote and we show the actual text of Set seeing the seed goddess. He leaps upon her like a ram, tries to rape her, and so forth. Then the specific, let's read the specific text just so you can get the piece. Now the great god had gone forth for a walk, and he, meaning Set, beheld, he jumped on her back, meaning the seed goddess, leaping her, even as a ram leaps and covering her. So he raped her, basically, and that's what he's talking about. Then some of the seed poison flew to his forehead, to the parts of the brows of his eyes. Thereupon he lay down upon his bed in his house, being ill. Then Anat, the divine, his wife, she went to Para, or Ra, her father, and he said to her, "What ails thee, Anat, the divine, you the victorious woman," and so forth. "I reached home this in the evening. I know that you have come to beg Set from the seed poison. Is it not a punishment, really a good punishment, the seed poison put upon the wife of the god above, that he should copulate with her in fire and open her with a chisel?" Copulating with her with fire and open her with a chisel means he tried to, in a fiery way, try to open her with a chisel, meaning he tried to rape her. He tried to penetrate her like a chisel. And Ra is saying, listen, he deserved to be sick. He tried to rape the seed goddess. The seed got into his body, it went to his brows in between his eyes, and that's why he's ill. Eventually, Offset comes to heal him. Eventually, after he suffers from the illness. Now, here we have the situation of Set engaged in the rape of a divinity, yet the seed semen ends up in his body and goes to the top of his head or brow region. This is the exact same story from when Tahuti goes to Set and asks for the seed of Heru to come forward, and it goes up to his head region, and then Tahuti has it come out of his head region and becomes a solar disc above his head. Originally, the story is talking about Set raping the seed goddess and Anat petitioning Ra on his behalf to heal him. And Ra's at first like, no, he deserves to be sick. And that's why the seed is going to his head in between his brow. Later, Offset heals him. How is it that this story where Set rapes the seed goddess and gets filled up with the seed and it becomes poison within him, all of a sudden, she's taken out the story and Heru is put in the story? Who did that? Where did that come from? Well, we can pinpoint it because this is when Set and Anat are married. So that means an infiltration of the foreign divinities and the foreign people had already happened. But we get more context and we go into this. Moreover, as we say, the Hittite myth gives more texture to its expression and connect. Some identify the seed goddess as Heru, who in this rendering is the wife of Ra, meaning wife of the god above, as it's mentioned in the text. In Canaan, as well as in the Hittite culture, the creator is called El in Kanana, El Kunirsha in Hittite. His consort is Akhtirat in Kanana, Ashutun, Asadu in Hittite. Akhtirat in Kanana is Akhtir. In Coptic, Heteru or Hathor is called Akhtor or Akhtir. And this is where you get Akhtirat or Akhtirat in Kanana, which is Heteru. Ashutun or Asadu in Hittite is the same divinity as Heteru. So the ancient Afurakani, Afurakani people who eventually migrated to Kemet, from Kemet into the Kanana region. We talk about Ra-Ur becoming Ur-Ra or Ur, Ul becoming Ul or El or All. This is where that title comes from in the so-called Semitic languages. And we talk about that, where they get the names from. But we quote from the Hittite myth, but we can give more context Akhtirat in the Ugarit myth is dealing with. So, and we quote, the next section begins the bulk of the text concerning Akhtirat or Heteru, as she's rendered in Hittite, or Kanana. We first see her sitting by the sea using a spindle doing laundry. She is identified in advance as the one who entreats El. El is Ra, Akhtirat is Heteru. During her labor, she sees Baal and Anat coming and begins to fear and tremble. So Akhtirat is sitting there by the water. She sees Baal and Anat come forward, and she starts getting scared, and she starts trembling. She wonders aloud if they have come to kill her son. This appears to scholars to be a reference to something that was a part of the myth of Ugarit that is not preserved among our current texts. The story of Baal killing the children of Akhtirat is alluded to here and elsewhere in the Ugaritic myth or text, but is nowhere found. We bold this part. In order to complete their understanding, scholars turn to the Hittite myth that they think is probably Canaanite in origin. In this myth, Ashutun, which is Akhtirat, Athor, Hathor, Heteru, tries to convince the storm god Baal to sleep with her. She is refused, and the storm god tells El Kunirsha, El Ashutun's husband, meaning Ra, of what has happened. El Kunirsha advises the storm god to sleep with her and then humiliate her. The storm god then accepts Ashutun's invitation, but upon finishing the act, informs her that he slew 77, even 88, of her sons. Ashutun is humiliated and defeated. So you can go to the Hittite myth to see the story of Set and Anat coming upon the sea goddess by the water, he rapes her, and then the later story when we're talking about the spell about setting a knot in Kemet during the time of Ramesu, and this particular spell against scorpions where it's talking about Set and Anat, and Set rapes the sea goddess. He gets sick. The sea gets in his body, goes up into his forehead region. He's sick, and then he has to later be healed. That story comes from foreign story. There's an allusion to it in the contendings of Heru and Set. When you have Ra and Heru, there's a very small interaction. Ra gets upset about what the deities are talking about and their decisions, so he leaves them, and then Heru comes and cheers him up and makes him laugh, and that's the end of the interaction of Ra and Heru. It is not fully developed in the contendings of Heru and Set because that episode is not part of the original story. That interaction between Ra and Heru is fully developed in the Hittite myth, El and the sea goddess, because that's where the story comes from. Set and Anat being married, that comes from Tanana. That comes from the Canaanite myth and then the Hittite myth. So originally, you have the sea goddess being raped, her seminal fluid, the fluid that she carries for Ra, because she's the sea goddess of Ra, she carries the sea, the seminal fluid. Set rapes her. Energy that's in her gets inside of his body, makes him sick, and it goes to his head. That story shows up in the contendings of Heru and Set. Heru is replaced, exchanged for the sea god. That's key. So the first thing that's key is there's a divine prohibition. We show that in the Pert and Heru, the so-called Book of the Dead, admonition or law number 11, talking about Kedem T, and I have not copulated with a copulator. That's one of the things you must acknowledge and prove to the forces in nature in order for you to be accepted by them to live in harmony with divine order. If you cannot prove that, along with the other 41 invocations to the other 41 deities, then you will not be accepted because you're out of harmony with divine order. That's proof right there. Then we show that when Anat and Astarte are incorporated in the language of, in the culture of Kemet cosmologically, that's when this perverse rendition of the story shows up. This is when the Hittite story, where the sea goddess is removed and then Heru is put into place. This is all part of the what we show in the article in detail, and we're just going over summarizing it now. Even in this perverse rendering, when they took the sea goddess out and stuck Heru in, of course, we went through the story anyway and went to its conclusion, it's still a repudiation of this sexuality. From the cutting off of Heru's hand to Heru having to prove to the deity that Set was lying, that he really didn't sodomize him, and the reason why he had to prove that is because he knew that if it was true, then that alone would disqualify him from being able to rule the universe. So all of these are repudiations of this sexuality, even in the corrupt myth. But then we show in the text what the original myth really was. Okay, so as we're going through that, then we talk about the foreign influence of the whites and their offspring in Kemet. We say that what we are witnessing is foreign influence in the cosmology. Moreover, this exchange of the roles of deities tells a political story. The so-called Semitic speakers who had infiltrated northern Kemet took Set as their main divinity. After centuries of infiltration, they would take over control of northern Kemet for a period. So we quote an entry, the Hyksos first appeared in Egypt, so-called 1800 BC, during the 11th dynasty and began their climb to power during the, in the 13th dynasty, coming out of the second intermediate period in control of Avaris and the Delta. By the 15th dynasty, they ruled lower Kemet, lower Egypt, northern Kemet. And at the end of the 17th dynasty, they were expelled. The Hyksos practiced horse burials. Their chief deity, their native storm god, Baal, became associated with the Egyptian storm and desert god, Set. Although most Hyksos names seem Semitic, the Hyksos also included Kurians, who, while speaking an isolated language, were under the rule and influence of Indo European. That shows the evidence of what actually happened with this rendering. Influence of the Indo-Europeans invading Northern Kemet, and when they show up, this perverse rendering of the text shows up, even though it still repudiates this sexuality. We've exposed that. During the Second Intermediate Period, a group of Asiatic foreign chiefs, this is another quote, known as the Hyksos, gained the rulership of Kemet, ruled the Nile Delta from Avaris. They chose Set, originally Upper Egypt's chief god, the god of the foreigners, and the god they found most similar to their own chief god as their patron, and then Set became worshipped as the chief god once again. The Hyksos king, Apophis, is recorded as worshipping Set in a monolatric way. He chose for his lord the god Set. He didn't worship any other deity in the whole land except Set. And we also quote Herman Tevelde, the demonization of Set after Egypt's conquest by several foreign nations in the Third Intermediate and Late Period. Set, who had traditionally been the god of foreigners, thus also became associated with foreign oppressors, including the Assyrian and Persian empires. It was during this time that Set was particularly vilified and his defeat by Heru widely celebrated. So that's just talking about originally Set. Set is Awuku, Kwekwanasi and Akan. He's Eshu. He's Legba, Yoruba, and Vodun. He's not the devil. That's foolishness. He's a trickster. He's a communicator. He's, he's the divine communicator of the Supreme Being. He's a protector. He's a number of different things, warrior and so forth. He didn't become demonized until the whites and their offspring, number one, infiltrated Kemet, started changing stories about Set and so forth, started associating themselves with Set. Now, just because they associated themselves with Set, Set never associated himself with them. It's no different than white people today trying to invade the Yoruba tradition and call themselves children of Yemoja and Ogun and Oshun and so forth. None of the Orisha have anything to do with the whites and their offspring. No spirit possession takes place between the Orisha and the whites and their offspring, or the Abosom and the whites and their offspring, or the Vodou and the whites and their offspring. They can claim whatever they want, but they're just parasites. The only spirits that possess them are their deceased relatives and other discarnate non-relatives. So just because they claim, hey, I'm in the Yoruba tradition, I'm a child of Shango, they're trying to claim Shango, but Shango has nothing to do with them. It's the same in the Akan tradition, Vodou, and so forth. It was the same in ancient Kemet. They'll claim, they see that we were worshiping Set, the people who were living in the desert. Set was the divinity of the desert, the god of the desert. The same deity that governs the desert, Set, also governs the planet Mercury, also is a communicator of the creator and creatress, and is also a trickster. This is why you find in Akan the same divinity that governs the planet Mercury, Aku, Awuku, Kwekwanasi, is also a trickster. He's also the owner of the desert. That's why there's a story about how Anansi became the owner of the desert. And he's also a communicator, divine communicator of the creator and creatress. The communicator is the trickster, the owner of the desert. It's all the same, and operating through the planet Mercury. They're all the same in Kemet and Akan because they're the same divinity. It's the same thing with Eshu and Legba and Yoruba and Vodun. All right, so we talk about that because the whites and their offspring associated themselves with Seth, even though he didn't associate with them. Then he began to take on different characteristics. Now he becomes a pervert. Now he becomes a dissexual. Now he becomes an enemy to the people. He becomes all these negative things. In earlier texts, you'll see Set in the boat of Ra, and even in the end of the text of the contendings of Heru and Set, Ptah asks, okay, now that Heru is going to be the king, what are we going to do with Set? And Ra says, Set will reside with me in my boat, meaning the boat of the Aten, the sun, and he will thunder from my boat, meaning speaking from my boat. He will be the communicator. Set operates through the planet Mercury. So when Set is in the prow of the boat of Ra, that means the sun is there, and the closest divinity next to the sun is what? The planet Mercury. So this is Set. So when they say Set is going to be in my boat, and he's going to be close to me, and he's going to thunder everything that I speak. He's saying that the planet Mercury, Aku, Set, is going to sit right next to the sun, and he's going to be the divine messenger. The planet Mercury goes around the sun quicker than any other planet. That's why Set became the messenger. Eshu is the messenger. Legba is the messenger. Kwekuanasi is the messenger. And they all operate through the planet Mercury. And the visual you see, so you will see text and murals in Kemet where Set is standing in the boat of Ra, and he has a spear, and he is stabbing Apep, that spirit of disorder that tries to swallow the boat of Ra. So Set is a protector of the Creator. He's not a demon. He's not the devil. He's actually protecting the Creator of the universe. But somehow, later on, when the whites and their offspring get involved, all of a sudden, Set becomes demonized. He becomes a deceptual. He's raping deities and all this other nonsense. So let's look at a quote from Ancient Egypt, edited by David Silverman. We just want to relate a specific, something that's related to this. Late period texts from Ptolemaic temples include Asiatics, along with the unwashed, the insane, and the bearded, among those forbidden to enter temple sanctuary. Asiatics, meaning the whites and their offspring, the unwashed, the insane, and the bearded, you know, like the Hebrew, the bearded, are associated with the insane and the unwashed, and of course the Asiatics. They can't even enter the temple sanctuary. They can't enter the temple. They can't even enter the sanctuary because they're seen no different from the insane and the unwashed. The white foreigners were recognized as social and spiritual deviants. These pseudo-followers of Set ultimately could not be allowed to continue to rule the country over the followers of Heru. Set, the foreigner, was thus ordered to be captured and exported. So when we talk about Ptah asking, the deity Ptah asking, what is going to be done with Set, Ra says, well, we're going to take Set, he's going to go up into the boat, and he's going to reside with me, and he's no longer going to be ruling, Heru's going to be the ruler. This story, even though this corrupt rendering of the story of the contendings of Heru and Set, because people have infiltrated, there's also a political story going on. The political story is because the whites and their offspring associated themselves with Set. Not that he accepted them, but they associated themselves with him. Because they associated themselves with him, the satirical text takes that into account and actually attacks them at the same time. So Set, representing the red foreigners and married to a knot and so forth, the foreigners attempting to usurp the rightful rulership of the land from Heru, the original inhabitants, the rightful heirs to the throne. The Asiatics invade. They're the foreigners, the followers, quote-unquote, of Set, the purported pseudo-followers of Set, representing Set. They're trying to rape or screw Heru out of his inheritance. The whites tried to screw us out of our inheritance. There was a battle between Heru and Set, between the original people, the original heirs to the throne of Kemet, and then the foreigner, represented by Set. Eventually, they lose the battle. They try to lie. They try to pervert the culture, create this sexuality, import this sexuality. Everything they tried, all the deceptions didn't work. So eventually, Set is captured in chains after Heru was placed on the throne, and then that's when Ptah asks, what are we going to do with Set? And then Ra says, he's going to come up in the boat with me, and I'll watch over him. Meaning, the red foreigner is captured in chains. This is after the Hyksos are defeated. And then they're deported from the country. Meaning, when the Set goes up into the boat of Ra, he's no longer going to be ruling on earth. He's deported. So the foreigners who tried to screw us out of our inheritance, now they're deported and sent away. And they're never to return. That's the political story behind the satirical papyrus, the contendings of Heru and Set. So even though they corrupted the story, and even though the whites and their offspring attempted to attach themselves to Set, even the underlying cosmology still repudiates their sexuality, and it still tells the political story of the whites and their offspring attempting to usurp the rule of Kemet from the original inhabitants. So we go into all of that in the text in detail. So that deals with that text, and you can read the text for all of the details. Now, just to ask the question, can Set be considered as possessed of a discarnate spirit in his attempt to sodomize Heru? And then you said, okay, you just answered my question. Now, one of the things, when we go back to the 42 declarations of innocence, admonitions of Ma'at, it's key that you brought that up because that's part of it. We talked about these are not just commandments that you recite in the morning and recite in the evening. This is no different. When people practice ancestral religion for real, we go to our shrines. We invoke the Abosom. We will go to Awusi. We will go to Penna. We will go to Apenna. We will go to these different divinities, Obatala and Odua and the different Orisha, and invoke them. We go to one shrine and invoke that force of nature. And when you have a shrine, and you have a real divinity that possesses and communicates, you can't just go in front of them and say anything. You have to go in front of them, claim, demonstrate that you haven't violated their etiwadye, their taboos, because if you have, then you will suffer for that, and you will be repelled by them. But when we invoke these Abosom, these 42 divinities, after the death process, the transitional process, and we must go through them and harmonize with each one of them in order to be accepted into the ancestral realm. One, we said we accept their energy, we harmonize them with them, we prove that we haven't violated their taboo, their etiwadi, and therefore they replenish us, right? We receive their energy and we align with them and we fuse with their energy. On the other hand, we also show that we must reject any disordered, perversion of that particular kind of energy. So with respect to Keret, the divinity that governs the caverns and the holes and the gateway to the ancestral realm, we say we haven't entered the wrong hole. We have not copulated with a copulator. We have not engaged in dissexuality. So therefore, we can receive the energy of that divinity, but by virtue of the fact that that divinity governs the entrance into the ancestral realm, the Dua, the womb of the great mother, the vulva and so forth, the great cavern, the sacred cavern, the Etwa and so forth, we have not engaged in perverse dissexuality. But it also shows in life, because we invoke these divinities in life as well, throughout the course of every day. And with our common people, we have a 42-day ritual calendar, and every day is governed by divinities, Abosom. What it's also saying, and people who practice ancestral religion understand this, that for us, if you have a perverse thought, and it goes against the 42 admonitions of Ma'at, the way you need to function in harmony with the divinities, it tells you immediately any thoughts that come into your mind that are out of harmony with these 42 divinities, you know it's not coming from them because they are the embodiments of divine order. You know it's not coming from the ancestresses and ancestors because they guide you to live in harmony with divine order. You know it's not coming from your ka, your kayet, because that's a force in nature itself. It's a divinity as well. It's a colleague of the 42 divinities. So anytime you have a thought, the divinity is governed, then you know that thought is not coming from them. It's either coming from a conditioning that you've accepted from a perverse individual or a discarnate spirit. So when you have, so in traditional culture, and anybody who's involved in traditional culture today, if we're going out through the course of the day and all of a sudden we have some perverse thought, like if somebody had a dissexual thought, in this culture, if you have any thought that you have, you assume that it must be yours. So if you have perverse thoughts, you're like, why am I thinking like this? And then you go to a therapist or you go to some other nonsense and they start to talk about what happened in your life early on and all this other stuff. In traditional culture and people involved in traditional culture, when you have an insane thought like that, your first thought is not, why am I thinking this? Your first thought is, who is trying to make me think this? Because we know that people engage in pseudo lower level witchcraft. We know that there are discarnate spirits hanging around. If we're not purified, and this is why Ojida is important, It operationalizes the culture. We know that if you're not purified and in alignment with your crown, this is why we pull libation and do rituals to our crown in the morning, but we can be aligned. If you're not in alignment with it, spirits of disorder that are hanging around, these earthbound spirits we talked about, they will try to plant thoughts in your mind, try to push you in one direction or another into perversity. So as soon as some insane thought arises in your mind, whether it's something sexual or wanting to murder somebody or steal or whatever, we know instantly, oh, that's a spirit of disorder. So we can reject it easily because we know it's not us. Our okra doesn't allow those kind of thoughts. The only way we can get a thought like that is if we've been conditioned by someone who's corrupt or some discarnate spirit is trying to influence us. So when we say these 42 declarations of innocence, when we invoke the divinity, we're not only invoking their energy so it can be infused within us, but it's also a protection. We know what to reject. So it automatically programs us to understand that any thought that goes outside of these 42 admonitions, that goes counter to them, must be coming from a discarnate spirit. And, of course, what we have done in the past and what we do now, we go to the ancestresses and ancestors, we may get divination, or we may just do a ritual, something ritual, to remove that spirit overnight, instantly, and keep it moving. This is why we do that. So it was not a sense of black people were so engaged in this sexuality that we had to create laws against it. What it was the whites and their offspring had invaded the culture. Now all of a sudden, and it's no different than here, if you're used to going to a black school and they're all black people there, you work at a job where they're all black people, a black business, and then you go get a job or go to school where it's 99% white, and if you're a little bit receptive, anybody who's receptive, especially people who engage in ancestral tradition, you will begin to pick up on the filth and perversity emanating from these spirits of disorder, as well as their discarnate relatives. Now you're surrounded by, every person that walks around has ancestral spirits connected to them. If they're white, they have their white, perverse, slave master ancestral spirits around them. If you're black, of course, you have your relatives connected to you. If you're normally not in the company of the whites and their offspring, you're not in the company of their perverse spirits either. But if you're surrounded by them all of a sudden, you're working at a new job, you're at a school, now you're confronted with not only them physically, but their discarnate relatives as well. And their perverse relatives will always try to whisper perversity to you. You will experience it as thoughts entering your consciousness, thoughts that normally don't enter your consciousness, ideas, images that normally wouldn't. Sometimes it won't be a thought or an idea, it'll just be a negative feeling. You'll feel the perversity coming from them. People who are a little bit more receptive and not able to sanction or repel perverse thoughts, all of a sudden they're getting these ideas like, maybe I should start stealing, maybe I should lower my moral. Maybe homosexuality is all right. This is coming from these discarnate spirits. These texts in ancient Kemet not only show you how to infuse proper energy, harmonious energy, but it also shows you that if any thought like that enters your mind, you know it's not coming from you. It must be coming from perverse, discarnate spirits of either criminals in your own blood circle or the whites and their offspring. Once they invaded our culture and they were living amongst us in certain areas in the north, then these discarnate spirits of their relatives are now trying to communicate with our people. And some people start having perverse thoughts, so we know right away this is the whites and their offspring. It's not us. So we didn't even have to engage in the thought. What happens is, and this is a fail-safe, it's a mechanism to protect against disorder. When you have these 42 admonitions and you learn about them throughout the course of your life, when some thought like this sexuality or something else comes into your mind, theft and all the different 42 admonitions, I have not stolen, I have not, destroyed temple offerings and all these different things, it's not only saying, hey, don't do this. It is saying that, don't do this because that's criminal. But it's also saying, if you have that thought, then number one, it's not coming from you. And you should know that. It's not coming from the deities. It's not coming from your ancestors and ancestors. It's coming from a discarnate spirit. Therefore, you need to do what you need to do to repel that spirit so that those thoughts won't come into your head anymore and you won't act on them. So it's a fail-safe. If the thoughts show up, then there's a remedy for it. You can ritually dispose of those entities, repel those entities, and those thoughts will never come to you again. So you will never even engage in it. So that's a preventative measure. These laws are not just admonitions. They're also preventative. So all of that is tied up into the cosmology. None of the whites in the offspring, of course, could give that kind of analysis, and they're not going to give that kind of analysis. And people who were not engaged in ancestral religion would not have not been able to see that within the text. They couldn't see that because they don't engage these practices on a regular basis. Anybody who engages traditional ancestral religion, they know this. This is common knowledge right off the bat. When these various laws are laid out, it's not just we have a set of rules, we have to follow them. If we don't follow them, we get punished. It's a set of rules, and you should follow them, yes. However, it's also saying that if thoughts that circumvent these rules enter you, enter your consciousness, you know that there's a presence of a discarnate spirit, a disordered spirit, and now you know what you need to do so that, number one, you get rid of the spirit and you never circumvent the law. Just because the thought came into your mind, you can get rid of the thought, get rid of the entity, and still stay in harmony with divine order. Whereas other people, they get the thought in their mind, the whites in their offspring, they say, well, this must be me, this is who I am, this is how I feel, and I'm just going to do it because this is what I am. And then they move forward and do it. Of course, that spirit's a disorder anyway. And those of us who have been taken away from ancestral culture, any perverse thought that comes into our head, the first thing we think is, well, that must be me, so I'm just going to act on it, I'm going to live my life, and this is how I feel, and this is it. And it wasn't their thought the whole time. They're being programmed. Other people will say, why am I having these thoughts? What's wrong with me? Why am I thinking things that are actually destructive, immoral, criminal? Why am I having these thoughts? I must be crazy. And then they either self-medicate or, you know, through drugs and alcohol, or they go see a therapist or they go see a pastor and get even more misinformation. They're told to worship a fictional white character or whatever. So when you understand ancestral culture, you know that every thought that enters your sphere of awareness is not yours. Just like every time you get on the phone, you know that's a signal, somebody's voice being transmitted. You know those aren't your thoughts. When you hear the phone, when you hear somebody talking through the phone, somebody else speaking, you're picking up on sound vibration. You can make that determination, that distinction. You can discern that. When spiritual entities are communicating and flooding your mind with thoughts and you're not repelling them because you're kind of out of alignment with order, normally you can repel them with ease. But if you're out of alignment, if you're weakened, your immunity is weakened, your spiritual immunity is weakened, then, hey, those thoughts will hit you. Just like if your physical immunity is weak, the parasites that normally bounce right off of you, if you expel with ease, they can get inside and make you sick. Spiritual immunity is low. Those discarnate spirits that you can normally repel without even thinking about it, now they can penetrate your aura. Now they can get inside and cause you to have foolish thoughts. If you're in the culture, you know right away, these thoughts aren't mine. I must have had low defenses today. I need to get back on my stuff. I need to purify and repel these spirits. If you're not involved in culture, you'll think that these are your thoughts. You'll either follow them because you think it's you and you just engage in it, or you think there's something wrong with you, that you're going crazy, and then you try to figure out a way to respond to that. Okay, so what I want to do, if there are anybody, a number of people on the phone line, if anybody wants to has a question or a comment, I think it's you click on one or click, I think it's clicking on one to raise your hand, and then we'll call on you. In the meantime, let's see. Okay, so do we have one question? Do we have thoughts that aren't influenced by any type of spirit? The vast majority of your thoughts should be streaming from your own Akra, your soul, your divine consciousness, that dwells in the head region, and that's what you should be aligning with. Your soul, your divinity, your Ori Inu, your Ka, your Kaet, encoded within that force in nature that's been assigned to you by the Supreme Being, is your specific function in creation, what you are to do, how you are to operate, how to harmonize your thoughts, intentions, and actions with that force. Your very life focus, the reason you came into the world, your Inkra and Inkrapia. It's encoded within your Kra, within your head. Just like you have a physical brain, you have a spirit brain, and encoded with that is all the programs that you need to function harmoniously. Now, as we move throughout and interact in creation with people who are connected to us, as well as other entities, if we lower our defenses, just like physically, if you don't take care of your body, if you don't get enough sleep, if you don't exercise, if you don't eat properly, then your immune system is lowered, and then, thoughts or quote-unquote parasites, microbes or whatever can invade and make you sick where normally you could repel them. It's the same thing spiritually. If you're in alignment with what you should be doing normally, then you can move throughout creation and do what you need to do, and the vast majority of the things that you focus on is what's coming from within you, coming from your own Kra, but also coming from your experiences, the things that you've inculcated within your life, the experiences that you've had, things you've learned from other people, and all that kind of stuff, as well as guidance you get from other people, and you get guidance from your ancestors and ancestors for most of the things you feel and think are coming from you. If you lower your defenses because you're not living in harmony with your Kra, not living in harmony with Ma'ad, Ma'at, then you lower your spiritual immunity, and these discarnate perverse spirits can now, they're always trying to influence you, but normally you repel them. It's like two magnets on a table, you repel them with ease, and their projections can't get to you. However, if you lower your spiritual immunity, then their projections will penetrate, and now their thoughts are influencing yours. And if you don't recognize that these are not your thoughts, your ideas, whether it's spiritual or it's been encoded, just like it can be encoded through Christianity or television or school or whatever, they brainwash us with false history, false cosmology, pseudo-religion. We read this stuff, we listen to it, we memorize it, we internalize it, and now we have been programmed and we're running off of the program of the whites and their offspring. That's one way they do it. Another way is directly a spirit trying to speak to you directly, trying to plant thoughts in your head directly. And when that happens, if your spirit, your defense is low, then it's a problem. But typically, if you're just on a basic level, spiritually, of doing what you're supposed to do, you can easily repel those thoughts, and if something unusual comes in, you can tell the difference. And this is one reason to deal with your Kra, going to your shrine, engaging in susu hong, as we call it in our Akan culture, or meditation, with your Kra and with the abosom that you were born with and your ancestresses and ancestors. When you engage that process on a regular basis, then you can easily determine, much more easily, when the thoughts that you have, the stream of thoughts, are your own, coming from your own experiences, your own desires, even your own conditionings or whatever, and those foreign thoughts that almost seem similar on a regular basis, but when you engage in spiritual practice, you know, okay, these are foreign thoughts. This is not normal. This is not my idea. You can easily tell at that point because you've been engaging the spiritual process and you become familiar with the way that you're communicates with you, the way the Abosom communicate with you, your Insamanfo communicate with you, and then foreigners influence. Okay, and one brother said, carnate and discarnate beings, at times thoughts, projections can animate and inanimate objects in place. That's right. Okay, so I think we have a call. Let me check and see. Maybe Jimmo.
Yes, sir. How's everything?
That's up. Good. I couldn't hear. What's your name? I couldn't hear what you said.
No, it's me, Brother E from the New England area. Calling. I have a question.
Okay. What's up?
Yes. The one thing I find, this is a good topic that you talked about today, about this sexuality, because I find amongst our people, particularly here in the West, that this is a serious rise, an out-of-control rise with homosexuality, this sexuality, in all aspects, which was
right.
Already planned and scripted for such a time now that most of them now have their rights in all forms
of political. Hold on one second. I just want to announce, for people who want to stay on the show in the overtime section, you only have 3 more minutes. The show actually cuts off on the internet at 11 o'clock. We're going to go a few minutes in the overtime. If you want to continue to listen to the show, you would have to call in. The call-in number is 657-383-0635. You got 3 minutes to call in, or else if you're listening on the internet, then the show is going to cut off on the internet, but it will continue on the phone line. So you got a little bit less than 3 minutes to call in if you want to continue to listen past 11 o'clock, 657-383-0635. For those who can't call in, we appreciate you coming on the show, checking us out. Go to our website at ogirafo.com, O-D-W. IRAFO.com/Nhoma. We have our soft cover books that we're selling. And of course, we also have the free ebook versions. We're trying to raise funds through the sale of our soft cover publications. We're going to have an event. We're going to be in June. We're going to be passing out free books. We've done that at all the events since September. We've given away almost 300 free copies of our book, soft cover, so we want to do that again. So we're trying to raise funds so we can inform the community. Our events are free. We do not charge people to come to our events for presentations, lectures, workshops, training. We don't charge people a speaker's fee to bring us out to their city, so we want to make things as free as possible. And the community support does that. So if you want to order some of our soft cover version books, on one hand, you'll get a good book. Or books. On the other hand, you will help us to, you know, brother, thanks for letting me do that, but go ahead.
Yes, and now that most of these people that's in this disorder are in political powers or, you know, high positions, and now we find ourselves now that the pedophiles and the one that they call transvestites now come into play now with their own so-called foot in the notch. This, our so-called beloved president, has opened the doorways for them to come in now. And now, by the time he leaves office, he already does enough damage already to let our people accept this. So my question is to most of the people that, how do we deal with some of our people that still don't see the urgency that this is not something to play with, or, you know, it is a rise now, and they can't just let it throw the wayside.
Okay, well, right. There, of course, people are, they don't see the urgency. The way is with accurate information, which has been non-existent up to this point, because the Whites and Arrow Spring have, you know, launched this campaign. As we said earlier, they're trying to prove that ancient is, you know, accepting this sexuality and trying to make people accept everything. So once we get beyond that, with accurate information, now we can transform the mindsets of our people, because our people understand that average black person deep down inside knows that this sexuality is insane. They know pedophilia is insane. They know this sexuality, homosexuality, is insane. They understand. Some people didn't know that even though it was originally classified as a mental illness, white homosexual psychologists decided that they were going to campaign and take this sexuality or homosexuality out of the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, that,
yeah,
you know,
Tom Altero. Back in the 70s they did that, yeah. In the 70s they did that, yep, correct.
Right. So that was a political move. They removed it from being a mental illness to being something normal. And they created this notion of homophobia, which is false, which is non-existent, to try to badger people or browbeat people into accepting this sexuality. And then if you don't, then you have an illness, you're homophobic, you have a phobia. They flipped it from, that's no different than if somebody who was schizophrenic, a bunch of schizophrenics got together, campaigned, took schizophrenia out from under the rubric of a mental illness and said schizophrenia is normal, and anybody who doesn't accept schizophrenia, they're schizophrenia phobic. And so only the schizophrenics should be running the hospitals. They should be therapists. Like, you have homosexuals who are therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists. You have the insane, the mentally ill, doing therapy with people, trying to convince them that they should be mentally ill as well. So we have to give accurate information based on our culture, based on our reality, based on what's true, going back to the origins of our culture, showing why this sexuality is perverse from a spiritual perspective as well as physiological, show the true story of how the whites and their offspring have been attempting to force the acceptance of this sexuality based on the fact that that's who they are because their spirit incarnated disorder, in disorder, as spirits of disorder. So once we get people on that track, then they can reject and, you know, repel this sexuality with ease. They don't have any regret. They don't have any remorse. They don't have any hesitation. They're proud to reject this sexuality and recognize it as this sexuality and not something that should be tolerated at all. And, you know, when you have people like that, we have people who work in human services, the field of human services, who are therapists. They're getting this information, and now they are starting to infuse this kind of information with their clients. Because when you're a therapist and you get into that room with a client, it's all confidential. It's no different than an attorney-client privilege. You don't have to tell anybody, even if it was a judge, what you spoke about with that person. There's a privilege there. So you can talk about whatever you want to talk about with the client. And when your people are culturally grounded, they can start infusing that proper information because you know the Negroes and the whites and their offspring are infusing them with this false information about it's okay to be gay, it's okay to be a pedophile, that's just the way you feel, it's nothing wrong with it, all this other nonsense. So the key is accurate information based on our cosmology, based on our culture, based on our true story, and disseminate that. When people embrace our culture, then you embrace the fullness of divine order. You embrace divine law, and you embrace divine hate. You know what to accept, and you know what to reject. You know what is acceptable and what is expressive, what is repulsive, what is degenerate. That's what order is. So it's about restoring order. And the show called Ojida is about purification, restoring alignment with forces of nature, dealing with your ancestors as an ancestor, getting grounded, grounding yourself with your craft, with the forces of nature that came into the world with you, and then moving forward in that fashion.
Okay, yeah, much respect. That's well said. I was wondering, tonight's discussion you went in, is there a softcore book on this, or is it still working besides a PDF file on this sexuality?
Right now it's a PDF, but we are going to take these four different documents and we're going to combine them into one document for the soft cover. So we're going to do that soon.
Okay. Well, I guess all my questions answered, and this was very enlightening tonight because I didn't know so much in the history deep on how this is played out politically and socially amongst Africa people around the globe. So with that, Madase, please.
Okay, Madase, I appreciate it. Okay. And we did not get into the text on Ptah Hetep. Let's deal with that briefly. And that particular text is I'm going to pull it up right quick. And we linked it up in the beginning session in the chat, in the chat room. It says instruction 35. Test proper translation of instruction 35, the prepubescent sexual taboo. There's a particular text in the instructions of Pattaya Tep, the maxims of Pattaya Tep, what they call the oldest book in the world. It's the oldest composition that's recognized as a book in the world by the vizier Pattaya Tep, the Chati Pattaya Tep. He was the advisor of the Kera or the Insu Tet Kara about 4,500 years ago. He had a number of instructions of moral behavior that he bequeathed to his son, but also to posterity, to Afurakani, Afurakani people. There's one particular, there are 37 maxims of Pattaya Tep where he talks about what should be done and the reasons why and so forth, how to live in a harmonious life, an upstanding life, a moral life, as an Afurakani, Afurakani person. One particular maxim, however, number 35, some people call it number 32, is they call it a difficult text. The whites and their offspring typically have translated it as a text referencing homosexuality and being accepting of homosexuality. Of course, that is not the case. So the reason why we wrote this article is we properly translated this particular maxim. A number of people have tried to translate it. They've gotten caught up on a couple of terms. They've mistranslated it. This is the first accurate translation of this so-called difficult passage. The whites and their offspring, of course, will promote homosexuality, promote dissexuality, and say that's what it's promoting. Some of our own scholars have simply glossed over it. So, for example, there's a book called The Maxims of Pattaya Tep, and it's written by African-centered scholars, put together by African-centered scholars. When you get to this particular maxim, all it says is be circumspect in matters of sexual relations. Of course, that's not what the maxim says, but that particular maxim apparently to them was so toxic that they didn't want to touch it because maybe they believe, some of them believe, and some of the people do believe that it has something to do with dissexuality. Other people believe it does not. The reality is it does not. So what we do is we translate and transliterate the actual maxim. We'll read it to you first, and then we'll show where the whites and their offspring attempt to deal with it. Pervert. It says, do not copulate with a prepubescent girl. You have learned the taboo against the water upon her chest, meaning the fullness of her breath. That which is within her body will not be cooled, meaning she will become hot with lust, and she will therefore not hide the taboo behavior. She will cool down only after she has injured her heart, conscience, meaning after having suffered from violating the taboo. So the whole thing is about he's talking to his son, and there are many different maxims he talks about. Don't approach women in the wrong way if you want peace amongst the people who you are connected with. Do not treat your wife in a negative fashion. Be understanding with her and all this other stuff. This particular text is saying do not copulate with a prepubescent girl, and he gives the reasons why. Why it's taboo, how a taboo and taboos are divine prohibition, things that put you out of harmony with divine order, with the deities, the forces of nature, with your ancestresses and ancestors, with your Kra, and also sets you up for divine retribution, suffering, punishment. So it's saying, number one, it's taboo, and you have learned the taboo against the water upon her chest. We're going to get into that. So it's taboo for you, but it's also, he also talks about what happens to her. You're an older male. You're an adult male, and you're trying to copulate with a teenager. And we show in the text that sometimes the prepubescent girl They don't start menstruation. For example, we have a link talking about Ghana in the rural areas. The average age of the onset of menarche was like 16 years old. Some people would be 17 years old before they had their first period. In the more urban areas, then the age goes down lower and lower and lower, so it gets to like, 13, 12, 11, and so forth. But in certain rural areas, on average 15.6, 16 years old, sometimes 17 years old. So you have an older male, somebody in their 20s and up, who sees a 17-year-old girl, a 16-year-old girl, and they try to get with that girl, he's telling the person even before they even have the thought, do not copulate with a prepubescent girl. You have learned the taboo, the divine prohibition against the water upon her chest. Then it talks about what would happen to her, what would happen to him, how negative it would be for him. He violated a taboo, which sets him up for destruction, punishment. Then he talks about the negativity, the terrible effect it would have upon her. And it would lead her into tabooed behavior. You have more of an influence over her because you have more power, more influence, physical as well as spiritual to a certain extent, that electromagnetic energy that you wield as a grown man, just because your nervous system is more developed and the energy emanating from you, you have a more magnetic, powerful force that you can force upon her. You can control, to a certain extent, inflow of thoughts coming in and out of her mind. That's why some older brothers can talk to a woman, a young woman, and whatever they say, the woman just follows whatever they say. They can control what they're saying. They have that kind of influence if the woman is not focused. The young woman is not focused, if she's not committed, if she's not strong, she can allow the extra heavier electromagnetic energy emanating from the male, the older male, to dominate her magnetic field and control her movements and control her thoughts and the way she thinks about things and force her to reassess things based on the way he wants to reassess things. He wants her to reassess things. So it will lead her into taboo behavior. So therefore, you're not only committing a taboo, etchiwadiye, a divine prohibition. Now you're leading her into that, which is setting her up for punishment and self-destructive activity and retribution and so forth. And she will cool down only after she has injured her heart or conscience, after she's violated a taboo. So all the way around, it's a negative thing. Okay. And we're not going to go through every single piece of the text, highlight the most important part. The number one piece, the deliberate mistranslation, the prepubescent girl. What the text says is hemet kart. Hemet means female, kart means child. So it says do not copulate with a hemet kart, meaning a female child. That's key. The whites and offspring try to say it means an effeminate boy or an effeminate man. And it's trying to say that all the text is saying is, well, don't sneak around at night and have sex with an effeminate man because it'll be a scandal, and then he's going to want to continue to do it, and it's going to be a scandal for you. So don't sneak around with an effeminate man. There's nothing wrong with this sexuality. Just don't sneak around and do it. That's what the whites and offspring try to say this means. Hemet kart means a female child. So that's the first piece. Then we get into the piece hati f, means his chest. So when the particular text says do not copulate with a prepubescent girl, meaning a hemet kart, a female child means prepubescent girl. You have learned the taboo against the water upon her chest. But the way it's written, it doesn't say her chest. It used the pronoun F and hati. Hati means the front or the chest or the breast. So it says his breast or his chest. So this is the dilemma. It says hemet kart, not copulate with a female hemet kart child. You have learned the taboo against the water upon her chest or her front. But it says his front, his chest. So the whites and the offspring jumped on that and said, well, if it says his chest, even though it's a female child, what it really means is an effeminate child, and means a boy or an effeminate man, when it's just talking about not having a scandal at night with, in the darkness and in the shadows with an effeminate man, because you know how these effeminate men are. They're going to end up continuing to be very hot and want to continue to carry on the affair into the daylight and expose you for being a homo. So just don't do that, and don't put yourself in a scandal. This is what the wife and the offspring wanted to say, because it says his chest instead of her chest. So what we do is we prove through ancestral culture, through language and so forth, that there is a taboo against the water upon the chest. The wife and the offspring don't even realize that that's what that sentence says. They have a totally different interpretation of that, but that's clearly what the text says, and we transliterate it directly. The reason why it says there's a taboo against the water upon his chest. In Afuraka, Afuraikai, in various cultures, there is a taboo against the water upon the chest. That means the fullness of the chest, the water that fills up in the chest. When girls, there's an onset of menarche, the beginning of the menstruation cycle, what happens is the girl starts developing. The menstruation, the actual release of blood, and the full development of all the female characteristics, it takes a while. They don't fully develop. It takes a couple of years. One of the first things, however, that develops is the water upon the chest, meaning the fullness of the breast. So very often what happens is the breasts develop first before she's finished fully developing into a female, before the full, you know, cycle starts, the menstrual cycle starts. It's not fully developed yet, but the breasts begin to grow. If the male is foolish and sees that there's a female that has fully developed breasts, water upon the chest, he assumes that she must be a woman now. He can have sex with her, and then he'll go and try to have sex with her, and she's still prepubescent. She's not even a woman yet. And now he's violating taboos. In traditional culture, somebody violated taboo. What you've just done is you've just engaged in pedophilia. So you get beaten, you get killed, exiled, various different things, because you violated a young girl. She is not a woman yet until she has had that, you know, menstrual cycle. And we're talking about males. They go through their rites of passage. Once they go through rites of passage, they're considered young male. So they may be 16 years old or whatever. They're considered young male. They have a right now, depending on the culture, to marry a young female, 16, 17 years old. But the female has to be a female. She has to have gone through her first menstrual cycle, and she has to have gone through her rites of passage. If she has not gone through that, she's still considered a girl, a prepubescent girl, and if you try to have sex with her, you've just committed pedophilia, which can get you killed or at least beaten down. So, an exile from the community. So if you just go by simply the water upon the chest, it's taboo to identify a woman as a woman just based on the water upon the chest, because the breast can grow even a year or more before full development of the female, you know, fallopian tubes and sexual apparatus and the menstrual cycle and all of that. So that's the taboo. So you have to wait until they go through their rites of passage. They've been checked out by the queen mother. They're fully a woman. They've gone through their processes. They've learned how to function as a woman in society. They have their womanhood training and coming out ceremony. And then once that happens, then the men can, the young men, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds, can marry the young girls who are 16 or 17 or whatever. But that taboo is across the board. Another key is, until the girl goes through her menstruation and goes through her womanhood training, until that happens with her, the boys and the girls are referred to in different cultures as boys. So if we quote from the Kagatla culture, and here's from some Kagatla theories of procreation. Obtaining the opinions of a number of witch doctors, Ngaka, among them Natalie Morema and Rapedi Letsebe. Shapira draws on an extensive period of fieldwork to outline several topics concerned with conception, barrenness, and contraception amongst the Tswana-speaking Kagatla of the Dekwana Land Protectorate. And he talks about a number of different things. He also says, he notes in the first section of the paper that while the Kagatla once informed their children that conception occurred following the visit of an elderly woman to a bearded snake who resides in a pool of water, adults believe that conception rightly occurred following copulation and the mixture of a man's semen, Mari, with a woman's menstrual blood, Mosese. Brief notes on Tobalo sexual intercourse among children are also included. The writer notes that prepubescent girls were referred to as Basimane, boys, because they had not yet menstruated. That's an Apurakani, Apuraikaitni practice. Until the young girl menstruates, boys and girls look very similar until they start developing. The girls were referred to as Basimane, as boys, until they menstruate. That does two things. It shows them as just children, not divided up into sexualized categories until menstruation occurs, until the boy goes through his sexual development as well. It also shows that if somebody's being referred to as a Basimane, a boy, and it's actually a female, that simply means they haven't gone through their menstruation period yet. They haven't developed yet. So definitely, you don't, even if their breasts are fully developed, they still have not fully developed with regard to their full development as a woman. You cannot use the breast as a measure of whether or not this person is ready to be sexually active. If they're being called Basimane, that means they're still, quote-unquote, boys ritually. That means that you cannot have sex with them, of course, because then you will be engaged in this sexuality, which will get you killed as well. So that's a fail-safe against people having sex with prepubescent girls. This is the reason why in the text it says female child, hemis carved. But when it talks about the taboo against the water upon the chest, it says his chest, because this is still a prepubescent girl, so ritually she's referred to as he. And she won't be referred to as she until she develops. That's key to understanding the culture. This is why the text was written the same way in ancient Kemet, with the same understanding in traditional Afuraka, Afuraika. We've even carried that over into our culture here in America. We don't speak the traditional language, but we have the same mindset. So as long as the young girl, before their menstruation, before their period, their first period, before they start developing, as long as they're running around and playing with boys, you refer to them as, okay, all of you guys come in here and wash your hands, it's time to eat. Or if somebody is very rough and likes to climb trees and not very prissy or whatever, then they will call the girl a tomboy. They're not calling her a tomboy because she's a dyke. They're calling her a tomboy because she likes to play rough just like the other boys. But as soon as she switches and begins to go through her womanhood training and starts developing and has her first cycle, then the tomboy title is dropped and you focus on this is how a young lady acts, this is how a young lady sits, this is what a young lady does and so forth, and she's referred to as a young lady at that point if you still have a cultural fit. Of course, in this culture with the whites and their offspring, they promote tomboyism throughout life because they want to promote lesbianism amongst our people. But in our culture, we refer to little girls that are rough and play and climb free, refer to them as tomboys, only to the point when they go through their first menstrual cycle, the onset of menarche, then they begin to be referred to as young ladies because we want to make sure that they move fully into that role as a normal, natural woman. Of course, if they ever had any desires outside of that, once again, we know it didn't come from the ancestors and ancestors. You know it didn't come from the Abosong. You know it had to come from some incarnate perverse spirit through directly or through the wife and offspring trying to convince people through movies, convince people through song, convince people through television, churches, schools, media, that you should be a homosexual, you were born that way, you're programming people with music and so forth. But that programming, conditioning, as well as spirit, discarnate spirit, people come in contact with people at schools, in stores, in churches, in different places, people have perverse pedophile relatives who died, and those pedophiles' spirits are still hanging around the people. And they whisper to the young girl or the young boy ever since they're 3 and 4 and 5 years old, and they're trying to influence them. If you're involved in traditional culture, you guard against that from the beginning just by virtue of the fact that you take your child to the ancestral shrine with you when they're babies. They have an ancestral name that's harmonious, that those vibrations repel that kind of negative energy. They deal with ancestral ritual. They have their own little shrine when they get a little bit older. So all those kinds of things, negative thoughts, ideas, intentions that are foreign to them, we repel them. It's no problem. But if you're in a culture where you're not engaged in that and you worship a fictional white character named Jesus and you accept that, then you're around the whites and their offspring, their perverse little spirits can influence the mind of a child and plant thoughts in the child. You're around some degenerate relatives, people smoking, drinking, engaged in degenerate behavior, people who are pedophiles, people who are criminals, people who are negative people and they made their transition, sexual deviant, then those spirits will try to influence your child. And then people will see the child walking a certain way, if they're a boy, walking like a girl, if they're a girl, walking like a boy. They start only wanting to identify with girls if they're little boys and they never want to play with the boy. Or if they identify, if they're girls, with the boys and don't want to play with the girls and anything. Their foolish Negroes will say, well, they must have been born that way because they've never, ever since they were children, they were never interested in the opposite sex. And therefore, this sexuality must be genetic because even before they became sexualized or developed their sexual characteristics, when they were 5, 6, 7 years old, they were already showing signs that they wanted to be with the same sex. In reality, nobody is born a homo, never have been, never will be. In reality, what's happening is in our community, we're talking about black people, crackers are homos just by nature. In our community, what's happening is you have discarnate, perverse spirits of relatives and non-relatives that are influencing the child and influencing the act in a certain fashion. And if you're following a fake Jesus or following some Quran or some nonsense like that, and you don't have a grip on what's going on, then you will just allow this thing to happen, and they'll continue to operate that way. They will condition themselves. They will incorporate that mindset, take that on as their personality, when in reality it was plugged into them, it was forced into them, and they will operate as though these have been their thoughts ever since they were children. And they will tell you, well, I remember back when I was 6, I always had the thought that I never wanted to be with the opposite sex. I've always wanted to be with the same sex. And they will remember those thoughts because those thoughts did enter their mind, and they were in their mind every day, all day, year after year, because those thoughts were coming from someone else, this kind of entity, dealing with them. Now that we understand that, we understand where, you know, how to reverse that. So, but dealing with the text, we go into all of that and we show why the whites and their offspring, as well as black scholars, have not been able to properly translate the text, and we properly translate it and we give the cosmological and cultural context for that. Let me see if anybody had anything in the chat. All right, let me see. Take another caller. Michelmo, you're 5856.
Okay, 5856,
you just listening? Hold on, let me see. Okay, no, 5856,
can you hear me?
Yeah, okay.
I can hear you.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah, much needed topic tonight. You know, this homosexual, bisexual business is getting crazy and crazier by the minute. Here in Connecticut, in Danbury High School, they have just crowned a little boy prom queen. They have just crowned a little boy prom queen. Lots of madness going on between the homosexual and all these pedophiles, pedophile groups out there. Brother Quasi, I would want you to kind of talk a little bit more on, like, people that's abusive, like a male or a female that abuses their spouse, and how that is an inclination towards homosexuality and bisexuality, and even a man or a woman being abusive to their child physically, like overbeating them. But like guys that like to fight and just beat up on other people for no reason. Can you talk a little bit about that? Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Made I'll say for the call. Right. So that abuse, and that's just, it's a number of different things that are happening with the abuse. For example, males who are abusive to females, if you engage that process and you're constantly, you know, brutalizing a female, then of course, in her mindset, she's looking at males as criminal, males as evil, and of course, if it happens, you know, relationship after relationship, she's already being turned off from males. When she thinks about males, she thinks about pain. She thinks about suffering. Now, that in and of itself is not going to push her to this sexuality. It will push her away from just not dealing with anybody. However, when you're suffering like that and you're fearful and your immunity drops, then two things happen. This culture is structured to come in and fill your head up with, well, maybe you really don't like males because deep down inside, really, you're homosexual. Oh, you need to see this pamphlet. You need to see this. Deep down inside, what's really been going on is you're really not struggling with males. You've never really been interested in males anyway. And remember when you were a child and you had these thoughts about being with the same sex, all this kind of nonsense, and they will make people believe that deep down inside, maybe they're homosexual. I know an individual who was molested as a child, you know, by adults, and going to school, she was, you know, she was somebody who would kind of fight sometimes or whatever, but she was trying to protect herself. But the people were trying to say, well, you know, you sure you're not homosexual? Well, just take this DVD. Just take this pamphlet. We're going to have a class on gender and sexuality. You need to come to this class. She was telling them, I'm not a homosexual. I'm not a lesbian. I'm not a dyke. I'm not any of that. And she's like a teenager, you know, a young teenager. And they keep trying to force her to believe that her behavior is based on the fact that deep down inside she's really a homosexual and she needs to come to this class. Now, she's strong, so of course she repelled them and she knew these were just some crackers trying to do something. And she hated crackers anyway. But the ones who were not as strong as her are the type who would go to that class. They would listen to these crackers, and then they would start embracing this identity. They would lower their defenses. Their defenses were already low spiritually. Then defenses are low spiritually, and you have these discarnate relatives and non-relatives, relatives who were perverse, relatives who were pedophiles, relatives who were engaged in dissexuality, communicating with you and making you believe that you're drawn to the opposite sex. They're like, look at this person. Oh, forget about those males. They're no good anyway. All this negativity about the males. They're trying to push you towards females. Then you get set up that way. Some women who are lesbians, they have sat down and written down instructions on how to turn a female out, wait for them to suffer under the, you know, negative treatment of their spouse or the negative treatment of their boyfriend. They will sit down and discuss. You can Google it. So just sit down and discuss the steps that they take to get a heterosexual female to be a lesbian. Wait for them to suffer, be their close friend, talk about it, and then try to make a move on them incrementally. And as soon as you make one move on them and they actually receive a little portion of it, then now they become confused because they're like, well, maybe I'm a homo because I let her do that. Oh, maybe I've been gay all my life. They start getting nervous. And then they get assaulted with all this information, movies, documentaries. The lesbian has all kinds of information and other people to fill her head up with believing, well, actually, you've been gay all your life. You just didn't know it. And you're not really struggling against me. What you're really struggling against deep down inside is that the fact that you've been gay all your life and you just didn't want to accept it because you didn't want the stigma attached to you. And some sisters actually fall for that nonsense on top of the fact that they're, you know, smoking, doing drugs, drinking alcohol. That lowers your defenses. It makes you susceptible to this kind of spirit. That's why they call alcohol spirit. And all kinds of things. So the crackers know that suffering, fear, pain, all these things lower your defenses. So if you're suffering under abuse, suffering under some kind of pain, verbal abuse, psychological abuse, anything that creates pain and fear, that lowers your defenses. When you lower your defenses, you become susceptible to suggestion from the program culture of this white bisexual culture, as well as this incarnate relatives and non-relatives, especially the whites and offspring, but even relatives who were criminal themselves. And then you start having these perverse thoughts. And once you have the perverse thoughts, then the cracker can take you and make you believe that the reason you're having those thoughts is because it's coming from inside of you and it's not coming from outside of you. The way to reverse that, and it's the same thing with males, if they've been abused by parents, you know, or even going to jail or whatever. Different kinds of abuse, young males being abused, severely abused by just, you know, beating by an over-aggressive father or a stepfather or a boyfriend or whatever, that pain and suffering can cause them to, number one, reject and don't want to have anything to do with anybody. But once they try to isolate themselves, yet their defenses are down, then the discarnate spirits can move in and start flooding their mind with foolishness. And that foolishness links up with the culture that they live in, that they're surrounded by every day, trying to make you believe you're homo. We haven't even talked about the foods that they, you know, the estrogens they put in the foods, trying to push people hormonally in a perverse direction. The music that they use, not just the music, but what they put under the music. It's like they have in grocery stores and department stores, they play messages under the music that's playing in the stores, encouraging people not to steal psychologically. So subconsciously they're hearing messages, don't steal, but consciously they're just hearing music playing in the department store or in the elevator or something like that. They don't just feed messages about not stealing. They also feed homosexual messages. They do the same thing with videos. Those frames go by thousands of frames per second or whatever. They'll throw a few, you know, homosexual scenes into cartoons. The frames go by so quickly that your conscious mind don't pick them up. If you stop the frames, you'll see a homosexual act in a cartoon, up under a cartoon that moves by so quickly that only your subconscious can pick it up. So they use that kind of stuff to program our people. Shuts down those defenses, weakens our defenses. And once your defenses are weakened, then, you know, the discarnate spirits as well as the conditioning in this culture can get in and cause you, move you in that direction. And then you'll be believing that, again, these are your own thoughts. Of course, that's reversible. The vast majority of our people who are engaged in bisexuality, homosexuality, our people now, not the whites and our offspring. 80%+, 90% have been sexually abused as children or adults. And that is the reason they became confused, their defenses became dropped, they were conditioned to believe that the reason why it happened to them and not happened to somebody else is because deep down inside they were really a homo in the first place. And once it happens, then they feel like that's who they are, because this culture tells you if that happens to you, then that's who you really are. And, of course, the racist, the pedophile, or the racist will try to tell you that's who you are and that's why they chose you and that's all you are and you need to just accept it. They tell you they're kind of foolishness. That's what happens. So once it happens to the person, they believe that that's who they are. This culture supports that and feeds that nonsense. And then they like, there's nothing else I can do. I can never reverse it. The thought of stopping and going back to being normal, they're intimidated not to do that because this culture say, oh, what are you trying to go against who you really are? You're running from who you really are. They try to brainwash them and intimidate them not to go back to being normal. Anybody who says, well, I used to be a homo, but now I've gotten back to being straight, they'll start ridiculing them, saying, oh, they tried to pray the gay away. You can't get rid of being gay. They're just, you know, they're just trying to hide from who they are. That's abusive. Anybody who's trying to teach you that you can change and cure homosexuality is lying to you. They're trying to intimidate people. In reality, any black person, any black male or female who got into that lifestyle because they were sexually abused through no fault of their own, and then they fell into that nonsense because they were confused in that way, that can be reversed immediately. Dealing with your insamafo directly, first of all, anybody can become celibate instantly. Anybody, heterosexual or whatever. You can stop it. You can decide to be celibate today. Some people just do it just to see if they can control themselves and say, I'm going to stop for a month. I'm going to stop for 3 months. I'm going to be celibate for a year because I just want to see how I feel spiritually. I want to take control of myself. Anybody can do that. So any bisexual who claims that they're struggling with it and they want to return to normal, first of all, they can stop engaging in the physical act instantly right now. Especially, we're talking about people who came into this because of abuse through no fault of their own. Now, people who are just pedophiles and criminals, they are the enemies of the black community. People who are homosexuals and promoting this sexuality, they are the KKK. They are the enemy. They need to be exterminated just like the whites and their offspring need to be exterminated. But the people who suffered this kind of foolishness because they were molested or physically abused, raped, or whatever, first of all, they can stop that behavior immediately. Secondly, when they deal with their own ancestors and ancestors, they will help, number one, repel those negative entities from them and then remove that desire from them. They can do that, and you can return to normal. Many people have done that. So when the wife and the offspring say, well, once you engage in that lifestyle, that's just who you are, that's pure propaganda. So we make a distinction between people who got into that lifestyle because of violence, because of criminality, because of molestation, because of rape, because of incest or whatever. They got into it because of that. They've been confused ever since, and they figured that's all that they could do, and they've been having these thoughts ever since they were children because these discarnate spirits have been plaguing them. They can stop that immediately. The ones who are just filthy, degenerate, bisexuals who want to promote that because they're working alongside the whites and their offspring, they are enemies to our community. They promote bisexuality. They're pedophiles. They are the enemy. We don't need them. We don't want them, period. Even for the people who are engaged in bisexuality because of abuse and molestation and everything like that, you don't need counseling. You don't need all of that. It's not a situation where we have to show love to our brothers and sisters and show that we love them even though they're engaged in. That's foolishness. That's pure BS. You don't show love to somebody who's still engaged in perverse behavior no matter how they got into the behavior. You show love or law once they leave the behavior alone and it's proven that they've engaged in restoration. They don't need counseling. They don't need, all kinds of different kinds of modes of therapy. You can stop and you can get information. You can study, listen to the Kuku Tum Tum, read the Umen Shang, read the Wabo Jida, but deal with your insamafo. You make a commitment. You are an adult. You know it's wrong. You read the Kuku Tum Tum or read any text from Kemet. like the text we talked about, the divine prohibition of bisexuality, homosexuality, you know it's wrong. You've known it all along. Yes, you got into it for a negative reason. You continue because people continue to convince you, but now you know 100% accurate, true historically, culturally, ritually, it's wrong. You know that now. So you can stop today, and then you can engage your ancestors as an ancestor. You don't need any, we do not counsel this extra, period. You don't need that, and we're not going to do that. You're an adult, you can stop. If you don't, then you're just as much as an enemy to our people as the KKK. So the people who try to say that you can be a revolutionary and be a homosexual, that's pure foolishness. That's white nonsense. All you have to do is engage your own ancestors as an ancestor. They will strip that out of you, just like anybody trying to get off drugs or anything else. Okay.
Brother Crazy, am I? Brother Crazy?
Oh, wait. Okay, I hear you now.
Okay, yeah, some great points. I love those points. One point I want you to talk a little bit on is in relation to that is people that like beating on other people. You know, abusive, and how their abuse is also a sign of homosexuality in them. Like a man that like beating his wife, or a wife that like beating on her man, if that happens, or a man that just like beating on his children, how that's like a sign of homosexuality in that person.
Okay, right. So. And this is something we mentioned in my Al-Keru webcast, what does it mean to be Afurakani, Afurakaitni, African? When somebody is physically abusive, they're, you know, not just verbally, but then also physically, constantly they're beating on their women. They're constantly beating on their women, trying to control them. Some people would say, well, they just want control. If you're constantly brutalizing somebody, brutalizing a woman, you're showing hatred for women. A man that hates women is a faggot. That's the bottom line. And the reverse is also true. If somebody is a female and constantly attempting to brutalize a male, or constantly attempting to tear down a male and always hating on men and hate for the male, and if you're a woman that hates men, then you're a lesbian. You're a dyke. That's the bottom line. So that's seated within our consciousness. It's supported by this culture. They want us to despise one another. And we're not just talking about people who, you know, somebody made them mad and they pissed off or they get in bad relationships and they're sick of, you know, the way they're being treated. But when somebody is just, you know, a woman beater, or a quote unquote man beater, but most often it's a, you know, a male attacking the female. You have to recognize what is causing a male to constantly beat down a female. It's not just because she can push his button, or, you know, well, she knows how to say the wrong thing. If you go to work and the female at work pushes your button, you're not gonna punch her in the face. If your boss is a female, you're not going to beat her every time she pushes your button, because you know you'll get fired and you know you'll get locked up. The only person you're doing that to is the person that you're having sex with. So if you hate women so much that you want to harm and mutilate and beat them and control them, then what you're saying is, I hate women. You're saying you're a faggot. It is a manifestation of dissexuality. Inclination towards dissexuality. And it's the same thing on the other side with, you know, with females who are constantly attacking males in an extreme fashion. It's showing who they really are. And they show themselves all the time. Okay. I think we got one more call. Okay, Guillermo, you had a question or a comment? That wasn't a call. All right. Okay, so we're going to end it here. We appreciate everybody for staying on the call, everybody for, you know, listening the live stream on the Internet. Again, for those who haven't already, check out our website, odirafo.com, odirafo.com. Look on the HOMA page, nhoma.html. That's where we sell the soft cover versions of our books. You can also look on the Guamu Casa page about upcoming presentations. We are planning a presentation in D.C. We're looking at the third weekend in June. We'll keep you updated on that. That's the event that we would like to pass out, you know, distribute the free books. So for those who can either, if you want to make a contribution, you can go to our, we do have a donation page, but anybody who makes a contribution, of course, over $15, you will get a copy of one of our soft cover books anyway, so it's not really necessarily a donation. You're actually, it's not just, you know, just if you want to just give a free donation, you can give a donation, but we will send you a book. So for those people who just want to purchase soft cover versions, you can do that. If you want to make a donation, you can do that as well. But again, when you do make a donation, all of the events we give are free. The workshops we do are free. The trainings, the presentations, we don't charge people to come in. When we do divination for people, we do not charge for divination either. That's on the website as well. So the donations that we do receive, they all go back into supporting all of the free programs and the free books that we give out and everything that we're doing. So, Yedase, we appreciate, we thank you for your support of that, our various endeavors. And also, we also have the Kwadefo distributor program. If you would like to be a distributor of the soft cover versions of our work, of our text, we have 7 soft cover books out right now. You would get them, you could purchase them wholesale from us. And then, of course, you can sell them retail to friends, family, coworkers, and people you're connected to that you work with. So you buy them wholesale. You would be an independent contractor. You would not be working for us. You'd be working for yourself. So you purchase them wholesale and then sell them retail. That information is also on the NHOMA page. And then you can also contact us via the website with details. Contact us at any time if you want to be a distributor or if you just want to order the, you know, different books for yourself and for your family, friends, birthday gifts, whatever. Okay, so Medase, we appreciate you all coming out. And we will be back on tomorrow for the Egwa Marketplace Show. Our guest will be Dr. Afivi Adiro. She's a naturopath. She's involved in ancestral culture as well. And we will have a good discussion with her. She will be answering questions about naturopathic health and a number of different things. So we will see you then. Get out there.